And we've been listening to covering the career of the great Ronnie Spector. Although, of course, we know that Ronnie Spector was sort of forced into using the last name Spector because of her husband, ex-husband, who was abusive, turned out convicted of killer. So it's unfortunate that that occurred. That, you know, and I think it's long before Me Too, right? We listened to a number of her songs, right? Veronica Greenfield was her real name. She's from New York City. I believe from the Bronx, right? Is that it? I'm not sure. I gotta look that up here. She was born, early life. I thought I saw somewhere she lived in the Bronx, but I'm not sure. I can't see that. Maybe one of you brilliant musical geniuses out there will tell us if Ronnie was from the Bronx. Veronica, I should say. And maybe you knew Veronica. Well, Veronica was an interesting person, Ronnie Spector, and a great singer and pretty much a voice of her time and her era. And she will be missed at the age of 78. Lost half her career to a jerk of a husband. Sad. She talks to rainbows. That is Ronnie Spector. We'll listen. We'll be listening more to Ronnie later. Veronica, I should say. This is Radio Unnameable. I'm your ongoing guest host, Paul DiRienzo, and we're back. I took a week off, needed some time to recover and recuperate, and I'm feeling good today. Glad to be here with you guys. Looking forward to a great show. So we're going to... I have a number of things lined up for today's show, tonight's show. I guess this morning's show, right? It's afternoon night. And what I have at the top is an interview, which we have live on the phone with what am I doing here? Where is my everything? I'm sorry. I've lost everything. I got to find my paperwork. So anyway, yeah, let's get back to it. So Carl Dix is on the line with us, and he is going to be talking about the hunger strike at Rikers Island. And I'm just going to give you some background from yesterday's article that was in The Gothamist. Incarcerated men living in a jail facility on Rikers Island say they are on hunger strike, protesting conditions such as lack of medical care and access to other services that have persisted since last year due in part to the COVID-19 pandemic and lack of staffing at city jails. While the Department of Correction pushed back on the severity of the strike, now in its fifth day over the past year, now a sixth day, going into seventh day, right? Over the past year, more than a dozen inmates have died in custody. Violence has increased, and backlogs in the courts due to the pandemic have kept people behind bars for longer periods. And there's an interview with a detainee by the name of Irvin Bowens, who reports that his unit has been denied access to mail and packages, recreation, mental and medical services, and the law library to work on their cases. In a voicemail left with an attorney, he said these are mandatory minimum standards for a human being. And the attorney, Christopher Boyle of the New York County Defender Services, estimates about 200 people at the Robert N. Davarin Center on Rikers Island have not taken meals since Friday at midnight. He said staffing shortages meant fewer services and the unit where they're housed is particularly cold during this week. Everything is limited to a degree that's never been seen before, Boyle said, the attorney, and they've had enough. They finally said this is what we're going to do to get some attention. Boyle first publicly sounded the alarm about the hunger strike at a Board of Correction meeting on Tuesday. He said, if you got 200 men that are committed to a hunger strike, you know that some of those guys are ill or diabetic. What do you think is going to happen in the next 24 hours when they're not eating? I just don't know what you are all doing when this is going on and you're not doing anything about it. Other hunger strikers complained of the cold inside their jail dorms as temperatures plunged below freezing this week. Lack of medical care appears to be the most significant issue for people incarcerated on the island. Council member Tiffany Caban, whose district includes Rikers, told the Board of Correction that she met a detainee on an unannounced visit last week who told her the only way he could see a mental health professional was if he cut himself and was placed on suicide watch. The Department of Corrections said in a statement that detainees are refusing meals provided by Rikers but are still eating food purchased from the commissary. A spokesperson also said the warden is in talks with the men and is working to provide safe conditions. Most of the approximately 5,400 people at Rikers are pretrial detainees who have not been found guilty of any crime. So that said, and also with the new policies, Alvin Bragg, the DA, his new policies, where basically they're not going to be prosecuting people or at least arresting them, putting them in jail unless there's like blood at the scene of the crime. So that to me is a welcome change and away from the whole 1980s Reaganism that, you know, as supported by both Bushes and the Clinton administration and Biden when he was vice president and before that when he was in the Senate, of turning people of color into so-called super predators and stuffing them into these friggin' prisons. And now, after all these years, they're looking back on that time period, which was so acceptable to so many people, but in fact was a shame on America. Really? A shame. Really, something that akin to the antebellum days of slavery. I mean, it's going to be looked at, you know, what people called, like, you know, when they were calling out welfare queens, Reagan, right? He loved that kind of stuff. And Clinton and claiming everybody was a crack baby and everybody deserved what they got. And it turned out now, with the light of history, they're saying, oh, these guys were white supremacists and fascists and not the great, both on the Republican and Democratic side. I find that interesting. We're going to be taking your calls, by the way, at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. But first, I'd like to introduce our guest who's been following this very closely, Carl Dix. Welcome to WBAI Radio Unnamable.
Thank you for having me on.
Right. So I wanted to take a few minutes and give the background to what's happening, because a lot of people don't know there's a hunger strike going on right now at Rikers or the conditions that exist at Rikers Island. It seems to be a place where they're, as they slowly close it down and move people to other prisons, they're sort of left a bunch of people, a couple of thousand people they've sort of forgotten about.
Well, it's not that they've forgotten about them. It is that they are continuing to enforce the kinds of conditions that prisons in this society are supposed to enforce on people as part of a control mechanism, and not just for the people in jail. It's a message to people outside the jail that this society has no future for. This is where you could end up if you don't toe our line. And that's what's going down here, because the 200 people who have been refusing food since last Saturday in the morning, they're kept in metal dormitories that house 50 people each. They're not ventilated, so they don't protect you against the, well, they're not insulated. They don't protect you against the cold. They are also not ventilated, which is crucial in a period when COVID is spreading. These dormitories have no individual cells. Each of the four dormitories has 50 beds crammed into them, put close together in a period where COVID is spreading. And in fact, the people got put in these dormitories as a measure to deal with COVID. And it's actually creating conditions where COVID could spread. People have been locked down for more than 2 weeks, not allowed outside of those dormitories, not being taken to their hearings in their cases, not getting mail, not getting phone calls from their relatives, not allowed video conferences with lawyers. And you mentioned Christopher Boyle. He has now found out, not from his clients in the prison, but elsewhere, that his phone has been blocked by the authorities. So his clients can't call him. which definitely means they're not getting their cases worked on. But it also means that retaliation could be coming down on the people who are taking this stand. And the word wouldn't be getting out. And it's very important that people look at this example of people in prison, locked down, who are saying, we're not going to take this, and standing up and fighting back. This is a bold example, and it's one people need to take up. And people need to reflect on some of the things you said about Rikers overall, because 87% of the prisoners are Black or Latino. Many, many of the people in Rikers are there for pretrial detention, which means they're there because they can't meet the bail that the court set. So you're in jail because you're poor. In Rikers, part of how they control people is a combination of beatings at the hands of the guards and allowing prisoners to beat other prisoners.
Did you see that video? I think it was on Carl Dix. Thanks for joining us here on WBAI. Mm-hmm. It was a video on, I don't know if I saw it on Facebook or Twitter, one of those social media sites. It was actually taken from security camera footage, and it showed a fight club being carried out with a guard who's present while the head of the Trinitarios gang was like betting on was massaging one of his guys to send them in there for the fight. So they were having like Friday night fights in there.
This is part of how they keep the prison running. They enlist some of the prisoners in keeping it running by doing things like fight clubs, like one group of people, call it a gang, call it a set, whatever, get control of a certain part of the prison and bully other people who are not part of their set. This is all part of how they run these prisons. And the other thing that you need to talk about when you talk about Rikers Island is solitary confinement, because that amounts to torture. And we saw the impact that that could have in the case of Kalief Browder, a young man who was arrested at 16, charged with the theft of a black backpack, which he continued to claim his innocence of. He was held there for three years, most of it in solitary confinement. And he committed suicide upon his release. Mm-hmm. These kinds of conditions, there's been talk.
And lately in Polanco, I wanted to mention that case because a number of people have mentioned that, and we've been covering that here at BAI, who was a 27-year-old Afro-Latina transgender woman who died at Rikers Island in June 2019 in solitary confinement after they failed to provide her with medical care that could have saved her life for 47 minutes following epileptic seizure.
Yeah, and see, she was one of 16 people who died in Rikers Island last year alone. And we're talking about Rikers, but we have to recognize this concentrates the way things are in prisons across the country. It's not just a Rikers Island problem. Prisons, along with cops and courts, are a part of how people who this society has no future for are kept under control, and how the conditions of racial disparity, degradation, get enforced in society. I've called the combination of police terror, mass incarceration, a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people, and a slow genocide that could become a fast one. And actually, before we go any farther, I should say who I am.
Yeah,
may know who I am, but just as for the others, I want to catch everybody up. I'm a longtime revolutionary. I'm a follower of Bob Avakian. I'm a revolutionary communist. And I have been active on the front of police terror and incarceration for decades. I was a co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality in 1996. And I co-initiated with Dr. Cornel West the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And together we started the campaign to stop, stop, and frisk. So you know where I'm coming from on this, or you got a sense of where I'm coming from by who I am and what I've done. Mm-hmm. And see, what's important about this is I've been involved in a lot of efforts to expose the horrors of prisons and of policing. And doing that has gotten responses from some of the authorities, some politicians, who start to talk about, well, we're going to reform the police, we're going to curb prison abuses. They've even talked about closing Rikers, but it has been a long, drawn-out process. Observers have said that the conditions in Rikers are worse than ever. And now you got the new mayor coming in, the new black mayor, but his colors are being shown to be blue. He wants to bring back solitary confinement on Rikers Island. He wants to bring back stop and frisk. He wants to reinstate plainclothes police task forces like the one that murdered Amadou Diallo in a hail of 41 bullets, and he wants more funding for the pigs. So reforming the police through pleading with the authorities and even getting progressives, trying to get more progressive people elected to office, is not a way that we're going to deal with this problem. Mm-hmm. This problem...
Well, what about, speaking of elected to office, Alvin Bragg, the new DA? I've never seen anything. I've never seen a DA. I've lived my whole life in New York, and I've seen them all. This is the first DA I've ever heard of who's talking about, you know, chucking out pretty much the whole war on drugs.
Yes. Bragg is talking about that, and there's been a wave of such DAs across the United States. I think Krasner in Philadelphia, Fox in Chicago, somebody in San Francisco, I can't remember their name.
Chesa Boudin, right?
Chesa Boudin. There you go. Thanks for that.
New Yorker.
But what ends up happening is that these people are not allowed to carry out their programs, because you saw that when Bragg wrote this memo and circulated it, he got hit by the new police chief coming in over it, and he had to go on the air and begin to explain, well, I'm not going to let bad people out, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we really got to deal with it, because one of the issues that he was getting hit over was that he wasn't going to prosecute people whose charge was resisting arrest.
Oh, no. That's 100 years they've been using that one. That's like that's the charge you did when you did nothing.
Resisting arrest many times.
I think half of New York has.
And what it comes down to is, if your charge is resisting arrest, well, why the hell were they arresting you in the first place? And resisting arrest by itself should not be a crime, because you shouldn't be arrested unless there's a crime you were committing. Right. And if you weren't committing any crime, they shouldn't have arrested you. So
it's a form of arresting you.
It's a question of where is this going to go? And it hasn't gone forward, because they've been talking about mass incarceration for a decade or more now. The number of people in prison is roughly the same as it was when they began to talk about, we have to reduce the number of people in prison. They've been talking about doing something about police getting away with murder for a couple decades, since the resistance grew and spread nationwide. Police continue to kill 1,000 people a year, and a couple hundred of those people, the police will admit, were unarmed and not doing anything criminal when the cops shot them or choked them to death or beat them to death. So reforming this criminal injustice system that they operate is not a road for dealing with that problem. And
what is the road? You're begging the question now.
I'm not begging the question. I'm leading up to the question.
I know. Oh, he's teasing.
Bob Bacon's put it out there. Yeah. He's analyzed that the only way to end the epidemic of police terror and genocidal mass incarceration and all the other horrors the system perpetrates is through an actual revolution, millions of people rising up to overthrow a system that can only function by mistreating people in this way. And that's what's going down around this. And this is a very timely thing to raise at this point, because in a new talk that Avakian has issued, he speaks to why this is a time when revolution becomes possible because of the infighting that's happening at the top of the system, you know, because people can look at, say, January 6th and the anniversary of the mob attack on the Capitol that was trying to stop the processing of the election and trying to keep Trump in power, trying to pull a coup, in other words. Mm-hmm. And you have one side saying, oh, no, that wasn't a coup. The problem was the Democrats were stealing the election. You have the Democrats correctly saying this was illegal. It shouldn't have been allowed to happen. But the people who, you know, were the heads of it and pulling the strings on it, none of them have been gone at this point. And that fighting is revealing a certain unraveling of the normal way the system operates. You got the Republicans changing laws to rig elections while at the same time making it clear that they're not beyond using force if the elections don't go their way. That actually opens up possibilities to bring forward a revolutionary people, and that's something that we're working on, you know.
Well, this is a little off the subject, but, you know, you got me interested. No, I'm not saying not to do it.
To the subject.
Yeah, it's related. Yeah, no, I don't have a problem, but I'm going to ask a question now that goes careens away from the subject and talk about January 6th for a while and talk about the fact that the right and the Oath Keepers and all these groups, the Proud Boys, have been talking about civil war and that they want to launch a civil war. And when you talk about revolution, is that the same as what the right wing are saying about a civil war? Are you saying the inevitability, it's a good idea to have a civil war?
No, I'm not saying it's a good idea to have a civil war. I'm saying it's a good idea for the overwhelming millions of people who have been beat down, exploited, and oppressed by this system need to recognize that for what it is, recognize that their problems come from the system and not from each other, and not fall for the thing of being divided up and fighting against each other, whether that's, you know, street gangs in the Bronx, mm-hmm, or in Bed-Stuy, or, you know, white people in Appalachia who don't have enough to eat and are being fed the Confederate flag. People have to get out of that and see that the problem is the system and that they need to come together against the system and rise up in revolution, because the system is not going to grant you power. They're not going to allow you to vote capitalism.
Can I ask a dumb question, though, Carl? How is it possible to get a middle-class country of millions and millions of small business owners like the United States of America to go for a socialist system? It seems like mind-boggling to think that you could make a leap like that in this country.
Well, the point is there are large numbers of people in the society who are really in angst about what's been going on. I mean, you saw the millions of people who went into the streets last year around the murder of George Floyd. That included a lot of black people, a lot of brown people who had suffered police brutality, but it also included a lot of people who had not suffered at the hands of the police, but did not want to live in a society where that was the regular thing for a lot of the other people that they lived among and around. And people were even saying, raising demands like end white supremacy. Well, white supremacy is baked into the foundations of America, and it is all tied up with capitalism. And we need to bring that to people and get them to understand that. And yes, we're going to need to struggle with a lot of people and get them out of the ways that they're thinking and acting, you know, because you raise the fight clubs they have in the prisons. Well, the people in the prisons are among the people who most need revolution, but they are thinking and acting in a way of, I'm going to get my group together and we're going to go for ours. And if we have to take it from some other people who are just like us and in the same situation as we are, then that's what we're going to do. Well, that's something we got to go to work on. We got to struggle with people. We got to get them to see that they're doing exactly what their oppressors and exploiters want them to do. We're going to have to also struggle with the widespread individualism, which does have some material base in the large number of middle-class people in this society who think that they got where they are on their own efforts and don't recognize that it's the foundation that was collectively built historically by laboring people who make all of this stuff possible in terms of where the ability to have colleges came from. And if you go back far enough, it even comes down to where the wealth in this country was extracted from the labor of enslaved people, was extracted from having stolen the land from the native inhabitants, extracted from having super exploited working people, many of whom came over as immigrants either from Asia to build the railroads or from Eastern Europe escaping famines. We have to bring to people an understanding of the actual reality, which will be a struggle because you got people at the top who are saying we don't want the actual reality brought to bear. They want to make it illegal to talk about the real history.
Right, and I want to just hold it there. And it's 12:34. I know half an hour I said, but I want to keep you on in case there are anybody out there who wants to call and directly ask you about this stuff. Our number is 212-209-2877. I'm Paul. This is Radio Unnameable. Our guest is Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This is your chance to ask him your questions. We're going to just take a 30-second break. Listening to The Clash, Police on My Back, from their album Sandinista. And you are listening to WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo, and our number, 212-209-2877. And I know some folks say they've had trouble getting through for some reason from calling this. All I can say is just keep trying. All right, we got somebody on the line, so we'll give it a shot. All right, you with us, Carl?
I'm here.
All right, here we go. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the radio.
Hey, how you doing? I've heard Bob Vakey, and this is very nice and idealistic, and it's total bull. It's the animal farm syndrome. You think we're going to get liberation. Communism did not work too well, and most of this is a movement toward totalitarianism across the world, not just here. It's happening because we're way overpopulated. This whole pandemic probably is an attempt to really kill people. The injections they're giving, these so-called injections of, what do they call it again, the inoculations, you know, are probably going to kill people in 5 to 10 years.
Okay, well, there's a lot there, and we're getting way off the subject. We'll leave it at that.
This idealistic thing about we're going to solve all these.
The Supreme Court agrees. The Supreme Court agreed with you, right?
I do. Look, I used to believe it, too. But realistically, history proves that this does not work.
But we want to put it in a question. We want to put it in the form. I want to move on. We have a lot of calls.
Fakian is not the answer.
Do you have a question?
Put it in form. I basically agree.
All right. In terms of a question. Hi, you're on the radio.
That will be first in Bronx, New York. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
Talk directly into the phone.
Yeah, I just panicking.
Is this somebody else?
No. Yes, this is another person who's just on. We're going to take a few in a row. Go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Dix?
Yeah.
Yes?
I'd like to know, whether the party would reconsider its strategy on defeating the pandemic and look more to treatment of disease and expansion of medical care, especially health care. One of the grievances of the people on the island is insufficient medical care. And if you look at how medical care is delivered in this country, it's for profit. And when profit gets in the way, people die.
All right, great. Thanks for that. So basically, there are two calls. One says it's a pandemic. The other is the present caller is a little more rational, I think. What's your response to those last two calls?
Okay, well, let me start with the second call first. Mm-hmm. We have a constitution for a future socialist republic in North America, authored by Bob Avakian. And it lays out what society would be like in the immediate aftermath of the revolution and the months that followed and how it would move forward to deal with the contradictions and inequalities left over from capitalism. At the heart of that is that meeting people's needs is not best done by making it the subject of somebody making profit. And that would be especially true in the arena of health care, as opposed to somebody's going to profit over the needed medical treatments and care that people have. That would be something that would be socially provided. Health care would begin by having basic health care free, and moving towards having all health care free. And that's the direction that people need to take things in. And he tied it to the hunger strike, which is actually a very important thing to look at, because what is actually happening right now in Rikers and other prisons is that people who are being arrested and held in jail, waiting trial, or even convicted and sentenced, their punishment is now having included with it the very real threat of catching a very serious disease that might kill you, and being in a position where they are totally blocked from having any treatment, any vaccines, and any testing to determine this.
You're saying that these people at Rikers are an example that's held out there. This is what's going to happen to you. That's why they do this.
Yes, that's what they're up against. And one of the things that's happened with the hunger strikers is they don't get access to the doctors because they're not letting them come out of those dormitories that they have them in. And at a time in a pandemic like this, you're actually saying that your punishment includes the possibility of contracting this very serious disease that could kill you unless you have access to vaccine, access to treatment, because there's an antigen treatment, not the mm-hmm. horse dewormer, but an actual scientifically based treatment. But the prisoners don't get access to it.
Let's jump to the first caller.
Going back to the first caller, the first caller put a lot of stuff in there.
I know. That's why I was trying to get him to focus it. I really didn't mind him.
You were trying to do that.
Yeah. I didn't mind him being on or anything, but he just had to focus it a little bit better.
In terms of what he had to say about the pandemic, this is like conspiracy theory on top of conspiracy theory. There is actually a very real disease that spread around the world. It's infected millions and millions and millions of people and killed 5 million people. And that's what's going on now. In the midst, through the mechanisms of a profit system, there are forces that are profiting off of dealing with this. That doesn't make the disease not real. People are actually dying. It makes the need for vaccines very important. And vaccines have been developed that are effective and safe, and people need to take them. That's the only way we're going to deal with this. On his point about, well, this is idealistic, but it's actually leading to totalitarianism, that is just not true. This is not idealistic. This is scientific. It is based upon, and it goes back to what Karl Marx and people following him like Lenin, like Mao Zedong did. And to say that it proved that it didn't work is also not factual. What actually is the case is that communist rule, where it existed in places like the Soviet Union and China, got overthrown and overthrown from within. And Mao Zedong in particular worked on how that happened, how that came forward, and fought it through unleashing a cultural revolution that had people from the bottom who had been born after the revolution and involved them in fighting to keep the revolution from being taken back. But after he died, his
we got another call coming in.
Closely with him were overthrown. And see, this is again another real thing. And people need to go to the website revcom.us to dig into this and actually get to the reality, because they accomplished many great things in both the Soviet Union and especially China, building on the Soviet Union, but proletarian rule was overthrown, and there's analysis on that website about how that happened, what was achieved, what obstacles they ran into. Also on that website is the new talk from Bob Avakian, Something Terrible or Something Truly Emancipated, Profound Crisis, Deepening Divisions, the Looming Possibility of Civil War, and the Revolution That is Urgently Needed, A Necessary Foundation, A Basic Roadmap for This Revolution, by Bob Avakian, and it's there in text and audio format.
So you're not just anti-government. You're not just anti-government.
I'm not anti-government. I'm anti-capitalism.
Right. That's a distinction
It will take a revolutionary government to administer society in the aftermath of the revolution and remake society. Right. Because we're not saying to people...
But you can understand how people, a lot of people are so bitter, and that feeds a lot of these conspiracy theory ideas that that the government is just evil. And if anything, the Democrats are even worse than the Republicans in the crimes committed by Clinton, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, look, I formed the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality in periods where there were Democrats in power nationally, because what the Democrats and Republicans work together on is maintaining capitalist imperialist rule. Right now, they have a very sharp difference on what's the best way to do that. And grouped around the Republican Party is a fascist movement that has the initiative, and they are really looking to bring into being a fascist form of rule. It was no accident that all of those Confederate flags were flying in D.C.
Why is it so hard to convince Americans that that's what's going on? Because it's been hard. They go very quickly towards these conspiracy theories. It's the evil government. The Democrats are the same as the Republicans, even though Trump is an open fascist. And when you say fascism, it just bounces off people.
It bounces off, or they'd say they're both fascist. And that's partly because people don't actually know what fascism is. They view it as a dirty word to use against people whose political programs and agendas you don't like. And look, I don't like the Biden agenda. I think it is capitalist imperialist, but I also understand it is not fascist. I have studied enough fascism to know that you don't want to be messing with fascism.
Right.
You think it's hard to make revolution in a regular capitalist imperialist society? Try making it in a fascist one. Try making it in a setup like...
They're getting the seditious conspiracy charges. How would we like to get the seditious conspiracy charges? That's what they would be doing to us. All right, here, we got somebody on the phone. You're on the radio. Welcome to WBAI. Question.
My question is...
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Hicksville in Long Island.
Cool. Question for Carl Dix.
I just wanted to know, what does he think of the current state of politics due to, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema that are kind of just backlogging important issues in Congress right now?
Okay, well, look. Sinema and Manchin are capitalist politicians who have carved out an approach to succeed in their particular arenas. Neither of them seem to see themselves as we're looking towards higher office. They're more looking at how do they stay in office where they happen to be right now. Manchin is in a state that went heavily for Trump, and he has carved out for himself, I'm Joe with the working man.
Even though he was
very friendly with all these right wingers.
Wasn't Joe Manchin involved with that whole criminal activity around the coal mines? And wasn't he indicted at one time? There's some story behind him.
He has very close ties to the coal mines in West Virginia. And that's something that people who have whose legacy is in the coal mines need to really think through, because Manchin's ties to coal are not to the coal miners, but to the people who own the mines, who work the miners damn near to death with black lung and all the rest. That's something that people in this country have trouble breaking through on, you know, yeah. That you and the boss, your interest ain't the same as theirs.
Right.
And Manchin has the image of I'm with the people, but he works closely with the capitalist interests who are very deeply entrenched in West Virginia, and that's coal. Also, to a certain degree, oil is developing there. And he is looking at how do I maintain my position right here? Sinema, a little different, but basically the same. How do I maintain my position here? How do I ensure that I'm here for a while? And that, for them, it comes out to I'm not with this agenda that Biden and the other Democrats are running down. And this thing about, well, we have to keep the traditions of the Senate going. We can't mess with the filibuster, et cetera, et cetera. If the Republicans won't get with us, then I guess we can't do anything. And Republicans are basically saying to you, we're going to make it as hard as possible for people who we don't think will vote for us. We're going to make it as hard as possible for them to vote. We're going to move to take away a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. We're going to go for the jugular on immigration and all the rest. And Sinema and Manchin are saying, well, let's see if we can work with them. And you can't work with these fascists except on their terms. And we should remember, though, that Joe Biden was, as he came into office, actually saying that, too. I can work with these people, even as the people were basically telling him, you know, no, you can't. Look at our own vice president. We're now saying, hang him. They were saying, hang Mike Pence.
Right. And what is it about, just to start, you know, what is it about fascism? When we've been talking about that, we got into, slipped into this fascism discussion. What is it about fascism that acts like a, it's almost like a sleeping powder? That you just sprinkle fairy dust that turns people into something different than you thought they were?
Well, you actually have to look. I mean, we're in America. America was built on slavery and genocide and has continued to maintain those traditions all the way through. And there's, I know there's all this talk about the arc of justice is long, but it bends in a good direction. No, the arc of justice can smack you back in the face if you think the arc of justice is going to take care of it for you. This is a capitalist imperialist system. It's based upon exploitation. It has white supremacy and male supremacy built into it. And that exploitation and oppression is what is going to go down and what you're going to get unless and until you get rid of this system. And as I raised before in talking about Avakian's new talk, where he gets into the profound crisis and deepening divisions at the top of society and lays them out in a way that no one else is speaking of today. And then, even where people are beginning to recognize that, they've got no commensurate problem because Biden talked about, you know, the people who are opposing them on voting rights are lining up with George Wallace and all like that. Well, there's some reality there. There's a direct line from the Confederates to the fascists of today. And that's why I said before, it's no accident that there were all those Confederate flags flying.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he was saying the thing about, were you going to line up with Jefferson Davis or Abe Lincoln? Well, you know, frankly, to be real, there's a lot of people who were part of that mob and who were part of voting for Donald Trump who would choose Jefferson Davis in that situation and go back to states' rights.
Even though he wore a dress to try and escape from the Yankees?
Well, I don't think a lot of people know that.
They don't know that he was caught in a dress escaping, trying to escape?
You have to know a little bit of history to know.
That's the funniest part of Jefferson Davis's life, is being busted in a dress.
And they might excuse him for that. They might excuse him for that as, well, he had to do that to try to get away.
Right.
But this is the reality that we're up against, and Avakian not only analyzes that reality, but he points to a roadmap that gets into the way out. And look, if you really want to do something about the horrors that are looming over us, and I haven't even mentioned yet the destruction of the environment of the very planet that we live on, and you've got these fascists saying climate change is a hoax, but then Biden's got no program on the environment either, because while he will say some words about, well, we got to go back to the Paris Accords and all of that to deal with the environment, the Paris Accords were not dealing with the reality of the environment, because you got capitalist imperialists, all of whom are saying, I'm not going to give up anything that might let my capitalist imperialist rivals get a leg up on me to do something about this environment. So they're competing and taking us over a cliff.
Yeah, well, what about this whole idea that oil, all the things that we are forsaking now as the horrible impact on the environment, has the reason why the world actually has a much higher standard of living than anybody thought would be possible in the last 20, 30 years?
Look, that was the form of energy that was employed to build up production in some of the wealthy countries around the world. That was the case, but then you have to look at where it got us. And it got us not only to higher levels of production and material wealth, which is very unequally distributed, by the way, even in those wealthy countries, but it also is having an impact on the climate around the world. I mean, the polar ice caps are melting. And see, I see the commercials all the time about the polar bears losing their homes. And
right,
that's bad, but there's more than that going on, because as the polar ice caps melt, the sea level around the world rises.
Well, you've laid out all these problems, Carl.
New York is going to become like Vienna.
Yes.
Unless something is done around it.
And day one of the revolution. Day one. The revolutionary government comes into power day one.
The revolutionary government comes into power, and we actually stop a lot of things. On the front of the environment, we stop the drive for this country to try to stay an energy exporter through oil, natural gas, and coal. We stop that. We stop on the social front attacks on rights of women to have abortion. We stop police getting away with murder. In fact, we're going to have to disband the police forces. We can't immediately abolish the institution of police, but we can get rid of these institutions and actually replace them with people who actually are going to be public servants, who are not going to be people who are going to say, I feared for my life, so I shot him, and then get a pat on the back and get to walk away. They're going to be actual law enforcement professionals who would sooner take a bullet themselves than kill or injure.
You know how much trouble I get in suggesting that, Carl? I suggest that on this air all the time, and I get in so much trouble. I'm waiting for the calls to come in now. That is the point that gets everybody the most upset, when you say that it's not a policeman's job to come home alive, but to serve the people.
Well, that's what the role is, and you're a law enforcement professional. So why does the law enforcement professional get to kill a 12-year-old sitting in a park by himself who has a toy gun and say that he was trying to save lives by killing this young man. This young man was no danger to anybody. The cop rolls up, and before the cop car comes to a halt, I'm telling you exactly how Tamir Rice in Cleveland got murdered. Within 2 seconds of appearing on the scene, the cop shot him. Got off because he saw a danger. He thought himself or other people were in danger, so he had to kill this kid with the toy gun.
How about L.A. in that Burlington Coat Factory?
The woman who was in the dressing room.
Yeah, the girl, 14.
There was a guy with a bike lock who was messing with people. He was hitting people with it. You needed to stop him. He actually didn't have a gun, though. You didn't need to fire a fusillade of shots at him. You bring a bunch of cops in. You isolate him from people, and you can deal with that. A professional should be able to deal with that without endangering all of the people.
There was actually a time, as you know, Carl, as much as we think about the bad old past, there was actually a time before all these Supreme Court decisions that gave cops all this power to kill people when they were a little more judicious and were more apt to, like, hit you with a nightstick or something rather than shoot you, and they seemed to get along well doing that.
Well,
I know that's not, I don't want to take their side.
That's another discussion.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in the ghetto in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And cops were never nice.
Yeah.
In the ghetto.
Well, it's not nice with a stick or a gun.
Yeah, okay. They beat you with nightsticks instead of gunning you down. But they were never law enforcement professionals in that way. I remember one night when a cop handcuffed and was dragging an epileptic woman that everyone in the neighborhood knew was epileptic. I was about 6 or 7 years old at the time. And I figured, well, he must not know. And I went up to tell him, "Mister, she's not drunk. She's sick. She needs her medicine." He pulled his gun out on me, threatened to shoot me. I'm 6 or 7 years old, and I'm not a big guy who looked older. Number of adults came around. He called for backup, and a police riot occurred in that neighborhood. Cops just showed up and started beating black people.
Mm-hmm.
And the cop who started this was black. One of the first black cops on the force.
And it's more to do with position than race.
That it wasn't skin color.
Yeah.
Because his color was blue.
Right. We have another caller who wants to talk to you. Oh, I guess not. We lost them. I'll give them another chance. Just to start wrapping up, thanks for staying on. Much longer than we thought, but I think it was a very interesting and productive conversation. And you're on the radio. Welcome to WBAI.
Paul?
Yeah, go ahead. Question or comment?
I'd like to challenge Mr. Dix on this shot thing to stem the pandemic. If you do the science, even the people who invented the shot tell you that it fails to stop the spread. If the purpose is to stop the spread, the only way to stop the spread is to treat the disease as soon as possible. And there are treatments now, low-cost treatments, as compared to the high-cost industrial pharmaceuticals on the market that will stop the disease. We need to talk to people who are curing people of the disease rather than talking to people who are panicking people to take thousands of tests that don't work, that weren't even designed to do what it is that we're asking it to do. We need to test for the amount of antibodies in a person's system.
Can you put that in terms of a question, though, so we can come bring to a point?
Oh, surely. Would the party reconsider its backing of everybody taking a shot in which the purpose of the shot is to produce a spike protein in the body, which is what the virus uses to cause inflammation in the body?
All right. Well, I don't know if that's exactly what we have to bring on a medical professional for that one, but I'll let you deal with it if you want to, Carl.
Here's the deal. Yeah. Here's the deal. Vaccination is a way to deal with disease, and I say that as somebody who's old enough to have been a child when polio was a tremendous scourge, and people were very concerned about polio. Who's worried about polio now? why isn't there worry about polio? Because a vaccine was developed that was widely used.
I remember it well.
And polio as a serious disease, I don't think it exists anymore in this country. There are places in the world where it still happens, but it doesn't exist anymore. Vaccination is a way to deal with disease. These vaccinations have been tested. People who are upset because they came up with them quick actually don't know exactly how they were came up with. This coronavirus is very closely related to an earlier coronavirus. I think it was SARS-CoV-2. And the work that was done to develop a vaccine for that virus was the foundation on which this vaccine, these vaccines were come up with. And they have played a very important role in helping to stem the spread of infection. That's one level they work on. Another level that they work on is undercutting the severity of infection.
But hasn't the medical profession tried to wipe out Native Americans with smallpox-infected blankets and black people with the Tuskegee experiments, and the list goes on, radiation experiments? I have a book on just plutonium experiments on prisoners that's like 800 pages long.
Yeah, I mean, I know that history, and I'm not arguing that this government is our friend and is doing stuff around this pandemic because it likes us. They're doing stuff around the pandemic because they're capitalist imperialists. They need to have a functioning economy. They can't let a disease run wild. They have to take steps to try to control it. And there are people in the sciences who, when unleashed and allowed to do so, will actually go to work and develop scientific approaches that are founded on in reality and in science. And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't know all of this stuff personally, but I have talked to people who are doctors. I talk with them around the time that I got coronavirus myself try to understand this and develop a course to deal with, a course of treatment to deal with it. So this is not a hoax. This is not something made up. This is not.
Just talk to anybody who's ever had it. It's not a hoax.
The virus.
Yes.
They came up with the vaccine in order to kill people, to inject, what is it, some tracking mechanism in you. I mean, look, if you got a cell phone, they've already got a tracking mechanism in your pocket.
Of course.
They wouldn't need to go through all of this.
Unfortunately, I wish more Americans were involved in revolutionary activity that meant that they had to be careful about who was following them around. Instead, the only thing they're doing is going to the bar. I hate to be so cynical, but that's the way it is.
Well,
we only wish that we had ration,
we gotta get people out of
reasons to hide our identity from the police.
Okay, well, we've gone well past the half hour.
Yes, you were great. Thanks for it. Well, let me give you a couple of minutes to tell people what information they need to know.
Okay, well, I don't need a whole lot of minutes. Let me just say this. Follow the NYC Revolution Club on social media. It is planning an action in support of the hunger strikers. Look for that. Go to the website revcom.us for analysis and reports on what the revcoms are doing around the country, and watch the Revolution Nothing Less show on YouTube. It's
or here on WBAI too. We have Sansara's show here
tonight. I was going to bring you to Sansara's show.
All right, I jump in on that.
We Only Want the World, hosted by Sansara Taylor on WBAI. Sansara is also a co-host of the Revolution Nothing Less show on RevCom's YouTube channel. They premiered their third season tonight because they premiere on Thursday night. Go to their YouTube channel and you can look at their previous episodes. The one tonight's important because they were laying out parts of the plans of things that they're going to do this year, including some very important activity around fighting against the attempts of the Supreme Court and the fascist section of the ruling class to take away a woman's right to abortion.
Very
January
good.
22nd is going to be a key moment in that. And I forget the website you could go to. Well, you can go to revcom.us and find out about it.
All right, cool. Well, thanks a lot, Carl Dix, for joining us for a whole hour, more than an hour, on WBAI and enlightening us to a new way for a lot of people looking at the world, a little different than the revolution doesn't necessarily mean you're against the government. It means you're against the system and its backers within the government. But why throw the baby out with the bathwater? We might want to keep that government and do something with it.
Well, we need a different kind of government.
How would Let's we keep it? Would we smash up the whole thing, or would we take over part of it and just change the people in it?
We would have to get rid of this government and construct a new one.
So smash up everything?
Based upon the initiative of the masses who rose up to make revolution. This is all actually spoken to in that Constitution
right.
for a future socialist republic in North America.
But I just find that amazing because, you know, they spent 200
the website,
years.
Revcom.us, yeah. Go there.
200 years building it. We're going to smash it down. Can we build it up back up fast enough that they wouldn't take us over? You know, is that be possible?
Yes, we could work. We could
take it down and build a new one at the same time.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah,
that what an adventure.
That's a whole new conversation that you're opening up.
But it's
up
an
here.
Interesting one. It's Let's a very interesting back. One. It's because that's the excitement.
Do
that would make it an adventure.
And because I'm going past my bedtime.
Yeah, I'll let you go. It's good. No, it's good. Thank you, Carl, for staying on.
We
appreciate
that
it.
Conversation.
Yeah, another time. Absolutely. Okay. Another time. Well, I don't know why that's going like that. Oh. Thank you. Oh, that was the specials. All right. Thank you very much, Carl Dix, for joining us on a little different than the news format, a little more free form here. But that's what it's about, free form radio. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Paul.
Oh, it was great. Good time. Thank you very much.
In the deep dark hills of eastern Kentucky, that's the place where I traced my bloodline, and it's there I read on a hillside gravestone, you'll never leave home.
sailing, and old Granddad knew what he'd do to survive. He went and dug for hard and cold, sent the money back to Grandma, but he never left Harlan alive. Where the sun comes up about 10 in the morning, and the sun goes down about 3 in the day, and you fill your cup with whatever bitter brew you're drinking, and you spend your life digging coal from the bottom of your grave.
Come and listen, you fellas, so young and so fine, and seek not your fortune in the dark, dreary mine. It will form as a habit, seep in your soul, till the stream of your blood runs as black as the coal. It's dark as a dungeon, damp as the dew, where the danger is double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in It's a many a man I've known in my day, who lived just to labor his whole life away. Like a fiend with his dope and a drunkard his wine, a man will have lust for the lure of the mine, where it's dark as a dungeon, damp as the dew, where the danger is double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. Well, it's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine. Oh, the midnight or the morning or the middle of day is the same to the miner who labors away. Where the demons of death often come by surprise, one fall of the slate and you're buried alive.
where it's dark as a dungeon and damp as the dew, where the danger is double and pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
There's a great and a bloody fight round this whole world tonight. In the battle, the bombs and shrapnel rain. Hitler told the world around he would tear our union down. But our union's gonna break them slavery chains. And our union's gonna break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky. Could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down, down, down. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down. When I think of the men and the ships going down while the Russians fight on across the Don, there's London in ruins and Paris in chains. Good people, what are we waiting on? Good people, what are we waiting on? So I thank the Soviets and the mighty Chinese vets, the allies, the whole wide world around. To the battling British, thanks, you can have 10 million Yanks if it takes them to tear the fascists down, down, down. If it takes them to tear the fascists down. But when I think of the ships and the men going down and the Russians fight on across the Don, there's London in ruins and Paris in chains. Good people, what are we waiting on? Good people, what are we waiting on? So I thank the Soviets and the mighty Chinese vets, the allies, the whole wide world around. To the battling British, thanks, you can have 10 million Yanks if it takes them to tear the fascists down, down, down. If it takes them to tear the fascists down.
Woody Guthrie, if it takes 10 million Yanks, with the Russians fighting across the Don, and our mighty Chinese vets, back in the day when everybody was friends against a common enemy, whatever happened to those days? Before that, we were listening to Dark as a Dungeon. From Harlan County, USA, the album, the soundtrack of the great movie, one of the great documentaries of all time, labor documentaries of all time, Harlan County, USA. And at the top, you'll never get out of Harlan alive, Patti Loveless. All music from the mountains of Western Kentucky. We were talking about Eastern Kentucky. We were talking about Appalachia, right? Coal mines of Appalachia. That's where Senator Manchin's from, and we wish he was not a punk for the coal companies who are polluting our environment and destroying our chance for a progressive government for the first time in, like, 40 or 50 years. Hey, it's not perfect, but you got to say this. Remember back in the 30s and 40s, what do we have? A pop front? United Front? Maybe that's what we need now against fascism. United Front against fascism? Popular Front? United Front against fascism? You know what that meant? All the different groups that don't like each other but have a interest together in fighting fascism come together. The problem is, obviously, we are far from united in this country over what the heck a fascist is and who is or isn't one, and does it really matter, which is unfortunate. We need to deal with a lot of history. I don't know. There's probably some people who are experts at it there. I've read some of the history. I was lucky to have one of the great history professors in the United States. I took several years with him. I didn't want to miss one of his courses, even though I wasn't able to do the whole thing. I mean, he does from the year 1000 to post-World War II. He did in the course of each semester. So you had the year 1000 to a certain time. And I picked it up at the – the English Civil War, which I knew so little about, and now I'm fascinated by it. I was totally uninterested until I started learning about it and learned about Cromwell and the Roundheads and all that stuff and the Cavaliers and the invasion of Ireland and all of that that came out of Cromwell's coming to power, the execution of the King Charles I and all that kind of stuff, setting the stage, really setting the stage for the modern world. And then after that, I don't know if I missed one, but the next one after that was, I remember the focus was the revolution in France in 1830. They had after Napoleon was, died, there was a loose government in France that a number of military coups, attempts to reinstate the monarchy, and it all ended up in street fighting throughout Paris in the 1830s. And I think that's made famous, that period of history, in the Les Miserables, right? And then 1848, the Great Revolution of 1848, I never heard of a guy named Metternich before, and that he actually got unseated. They actually had a revolution where Metternich, the Austrian Machiavellian prince, was deposed, at least for a short time. Unheard of in history up to that a major government figure would be knocked off of power, you know, of a throne or a position of power in Europe in the 1800s. Unheard of. Pretty amazing. And that, of course, the birth of socialism, and we talked about Marx, and we talked about the Communist Manifesto, which was published in 1848. And I think we culminated that part with the 1850s, with it ended with the Paris Commune in the 1870s, when Germany invaded and defeated France in 1872 in the war. That happened then, and it was fascinating for me to find out that the army of France and the army of Germany were having this mega war in the fields outside of Paris. And then when the Parisian workers rose up and formed a commune, the armies of the two warring armies of France and Germany actually united and then collectively attacked the commune, killing 30,000 people. Then I realized that maybe people's nationhood is less important to the ruling powers than the social class that they represent. Oh my God. Harvey Goldberg, what a brilliant guy he was. Unbelievable historian. And then he took us into the, right up into the Russian Revolution. And it was interesting what he had to say about communism, about Mao and Lenin and what they attempted to do in the early and mid 20th century. They never were able to develop a country without the suffering that the capitalist countries had. You know, America with its terrible conditions, the working conditions and slavery, and European conditions is represented by Germinal. You know, if you read Emile Zola's books, you know, the horrors of industrialization in Europe were not. They industrialized China and Russia, but not at less of a cost, which is sort of the goal of the early socialists. So that is a sad thing. And I think he focused on Lenin. It was an interesting point about Lenin, that Lenin in many ways was a great leader, a great man, but he failed at one thing, and that was his adoption of Taylorism. And who out there knows what Taylorism is? And so that was interesting. And then, of course, World War I and World War II. And Harvey knew, like, every one of those generals and all their backstory and how they got involved in it. It's the first time I heard of the Night of the Long Knives. I never knew about that before. Fascinating. Anyway, this is the scope of European history that is at the root of some of the socialist ideas we were discussing earlier. And you are on the radio. Welcome to WBAI. I guess not. Hi, you're on the air. Can you hear me? You dare?
Happy Russian New Year.
Is there? Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Listen, I'm half my family's Eastern European. This was the day we did the Christmas tree on the 25th for the Americans, but the real day was Three Kings Day.
You got it. far as history goes, I spent about 2.5 years living in a place that's always disparaged by sophisticated, you know, yuppies in Manhattan called Scranton.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working out there. And
with that TV show. I love that TV, that comedy about the workplace.
Yeah, and of course, the people, the actoids who performed never went to Scranton, so they had no idea.
They have no idea what it's really like? Okay.
Yeah, but I can tell you this much. There was a guy named John Mitchell, who was a coal miner president back in 1900.
Oh, my God, yeah, that's ancient history. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and he, I never knew about any of the stuff until I lived there. He used to tell me, I used to get books and stuff like that. And he was so revered by the rank and file of the miners, and mostly immigrants, like Hungarians like your people and Slovaks and Russians like my people, right? Poles, Czechs, Italians, Irish. That when they heard about an assassination, the president was assassinated in 1900. Everybody went out into the squares. They went to the churches. They were horrified. And when they heard that it was McKinley, they said, it's not John Mitchell. Our president's okay. That's our way. Let's go home.
Right.
And I,
well, who would want? Yeah, I mean, McKinley was like a business, was part of the business, the Gilded Age business era, you know?
Well, the thing that got me was out there, the strike of 1902 that John Mitchell planned. I mean, the conditions in the mines just, it didn't seem possible where people worked. And he targeted September, 1902? And literally, they weren't sure how many guys were going to go out on strike. And, you know, you had such bitter divisions between the Irish, the Italians, the Poles, the Russians, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, because the companies fomented that, right?
Yeah.
The first day that they went on strike, 90,000 guys walked out. Nobody could believe it. There's actually photographs of the streets of Scranton with men walking in their Sunday jackets on strike, and eventually 125,000 people walked out.
Cool.
That led, I never knew anything about this until
right,
I
right, they
there.
Don't teach anything. You got to read Jeremy... what was there? There's this one book called Strike. I bought that book and I was reading it in a labor politics course in college. And the professor saw me reading it and he got mad at me. He said, what are you reading that crap?
Well, like, what got me was that it went so much that Theodore Roosevelt, that's when he sided with the miners. That's when they were going to take over the mines because people, you know, the coal supplies were down and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So 1902 was the trial, was called the anthracite trial. Hmm. Literally, it was like...
The anthracite mines in Pennsylvania is where they would hire children to pull the slate out of the coal mines because they had little fingers that could get the pieces out better.
This is the grandfather of my girlfriend and years ago. They told the stories about that, but it was the labor attorney, it's late at night.
I know what you mean. That's okay. That's why it's freeform radio.
But the Clarence Darrow called 297 witnesses into the courthouse in Scranton.
What a great lawyer.
The best in the world.
Yeah.
And the miners and the owners of the mines actually said, we don't know that these children are suffering. Hell, they don't even speak English. That's when the trial went into, you know, weeks and months, and they won. The miners won, and that's what created the Department of Labor under Theodore Roosevelt. And the first Secretary of Labor was Terence Powderly, the Knights of Labor mayor of New York. No, mm-hmm. Boston, New York, Scranton.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And like I said, I'm a wise guy from Jersey living out there. I didn't know any of this stuff. You know, it was...
Right. Oh, yeah, it goes back. You know what's... I'm interested, you know, just... trying to study because I'm fortunate enough to live in Lower East Side and in Manhattan of all places, and so I'm fascinated with the history, of course. And I always wondered, you know, the on Fifth Avenue near Washington Square Park is an art club called the Scalamucci Club. I keep confusing it with the guy Trump's friend.
Oh God,
the art, right? the mooch, right? But the art club there. I'm going to try and find the right spelling of it. And that building is the Salmagundi Club. That's it. It's at 47 Fifth Avenue, 10th at 12th Street. And that building was actually sold to the club
by a family that was from New York, that were a merchant family from New York from the early 19th century, that was one of the first investors in the Pennsylvania anthracite coal mines.
Oh, God.
And actually, he lived down on Cherry Street when it was when rich people, and then they had a, guess what, a disease epidemic of cholera, and all the rich people moved to Fifth Avenue, which had closed the Potter's Field and the hanging ground they used to have there, and turned it into a park, a parade ground, actually. And so wealthy people started to move up and down that lower part of Fifth Avenue, and that was one of the places he was able to move to. And he made his money on the in the anthracite coal mines where they were having, were back in, and you could imagine, we're talking about the late 1900, imagine what it was like in 1840 and 1850.
And eventually.
When the children, they literally had children working in the mines and stuff.
In one case, like there was like this 8-year-old kid working in the mine. Why are you working in the mine? Because my father was killed in the mine and he owed money to the company store, that everybody did.
Mm-hmm.
But what gets me, Paul, I mean, the whole, you were talking before about the different things, the 1848, the uprisings and the 48ers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I used to go up in Manhattan near Schurz Park, Carl Schurz, Republican uh-huh. senator from New York after the Civil War, Civil War general. He was a socialist. He was a 48er.
Right.
I had no idea, right?
Yeah, well, there's lots of stuff like that. I mean, he'd be, you know, it's the McCarthy period put such a, you know, they managed to basically do a terrorism job on socialists and communists back in the 40s and 50s when they made them out to be some sort of horrifying terrorists. When in fact, the head of the Communist Party USA, Earl Browder at the time, one of his most famous statements, and many people, especially new leftist people in the 60s and 70s, hated him for this, but he said, communism is 20th century Americanism. In other words, like, you know, he looked around and saw a middle class 1950s America and said, well, this is what communism's all about.
Actually, a long time ago, I used to work in a different city every week in my old job, and we're in Chattanooga.
Yeah.
And there's the famous battle of Grant versus Bragg, and the guys charge up Missionary Ridge, one of the bravest things in American history. They take the ridge from the Confederates. Leading the charge was a guy I never heard of, Augustus Willock, who was a leader of the insurrections in Germany in 1848.
Wow.
Comes to the United States, forms a printing press in Cincinnati. It was like the German socialist workers of Ohio. This guy was like, had steel you-know-whats, man.
Yeah.
Straight up the hill. And they were, and he was totally, he formed an abolition society. And they were horrified by the treatment of the Native Americans. Right. This is 18.
I lived in Wisconsin, went to college in Madison, you know, and, you know, that's ground zero for all that history. It's pretty amazing. That's why they have this incredible land-grant college there, one of the best colleges in the country in a small state like that. Because they saw ahead the German immigrants who came from 1848, you know, first thing they did is set up a land-grant college, thanks to Abraham Lincoln, who signed the bill to do it. And if you, what was I thinking of? Of course, you know, Custer was German too, but I guess it fell short there. Custer was from Ohio. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, right. So I was out years ago visiting my daughter, and she, at the time, and she lived in Northern California near. Korbel Winery, right? And I remember we went over to the Korbel Winery. And how do you go to a winery when you have to drive the car? How is it humanly – like, how do you – like, how do they let you get into the car and drive a – I mean, to me, the whole thing was pretty fishy from the beginning. But I don't drink. I let them drink. I let my girlfriend and her drink. And they drank all they wanted. And I was, of course, as usual, the poor schmuck who didn't get to drink. But – Korbel was one of these people. Korbel, right? The champagne guy, the cheap wine guy. And he, in the tour of the winery, right, in Sonoma, they show us the it turned out when he came there and he built the winery, we come to his office. It's a beautiful, like, corporate office type, you know, 19th century style corporate office with the big mahogany desks and the windows and everything. And
outside the window across the parking lot is a tower. It looks like it's out of a castle.
Oh, no.
And this guy is a tour guide who really, the young guy didn't really understand. He was a wine guy, right? He's leading us to go get, take drinks and buy a few bottles of their wine. And he goes, Mr. Corbell, who founded the company, came from Germany after being imprisoned for his role in some political problem they had in 1848. The poor guy didn't know anything about it. And he goes, when he came here, he had a model, a scale model of the prison tower he was kept in built so he could see it out the window of his office. And that's
reminds
it.
Him.
Yes.
Holy God.
Yes. Yes. And you can see it today if you go to the Cobell Winery in Sonoma.
So it's a good thing you had nothing to drink.
Nothing to drink. I know. I can't drive and drink. No way. I'm too responsible. I'm irresponsibly responsible.
But that whole world of the 48ers and stuff, like in the Civil War, there were officers in the Union Army, and they were all abolitionists to a man. It was never read about that in school.
Yes.
Right?
Well, you know, and it sort of makes a joke of it, but it's actually based on that reality. The Tarantino movie, Django Unchained. The German guy, remember the actor got the Academy Award, that wonderful actor. He says, like, I really, you know, we're not from Germany isn't an Atlantic country. It's not on the Atlantic Ocean. So they didn't have the same involvement with slavery as the Atlantic coast, like
as Portugal or Spain, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Or England or France or the United States. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's always saying, I find this a bit barbaric and strange. You people, trading in flesh, the flesh trade, he called it. He says, very strange. And you're kind of, I find it quite disgusting, he would go. But then the joke is, of course, he says, but I'm not above using it to get what I want. As he tells Django.
The history I remember as a kid watching films, there was this one idiotic thing called Along the Santa Fe Trail. With the idiot actor himself, Ronald Reagan, Earl Flynn, and a bunch of guys. And it has to do with Kansas, Bleeding Kansas.
Right. Is that the one with where he has the coffins filled with Bibles or guns?
Okay.
The Bible
John
box.
Brown,
yeah.
John Brown is the bad guy.
Right, of course.
He's the bad guy.
Always presented as the bad guy.
I remember seeing this, watching this with my parents, you know, my sisters in the living room, you know, proverbial thing 50-some-odd years ago. And my father was like, enough of this BS, but turn it off, you know, that kind of thing. Like, Dad, John Brown was a bad guy, he goes, according to these clowns, you know. But the way they're portrayed, everybody's, you know.
Nobody, even his closest friends, accused him of being sane, but he definitely got things done.
This is how it was portrayed. There's Earl
right, as a
there.
Bad guy. No, he was just a guy, Alfred Adler. A great psychologist said that anybody who's like heavily into religion is a bit crazy, by definition. I wouldn't say I agree with Alfred Adler, but you know, you have to take into account this guy was a little bit bonkers, but that's not in itself a bad thing.
But and Gone with the Wind, oh, that awful Sherman, oh, he's terrible. You know, I mean,
Sherman, March to the Sea. I could play that song. I love that song.
You played that a couple weeks
while we were marching through Georgia. I was listening to it again the other day. Right?
You made my week, man. That's all I can say.
That's a good day. We have somebody else on the line. I'm going to bring them on. Hang on. You're on the radio.
Thanks for taking my call, Paul.
Oh, sure. That's what I'm here for.
I just want to – you guys are having this great European history reunion, and I wanted to say that, first of all, with regard to Germany, check out the history of Namibia, southwest Germany.
Right.
You might want to change.
Well, that was – yes, I'm sure that's very true, although not to defend Germany, although they don't need defending, that's for sure. I think that was later on in the 19th century.
Yeah. I mean, no doubt. Yeah. There was
a certain reason. You know, there was the socialist people around the world. You have to say this. All over the world, socialist, communist, or progressive movements – have popped up in countries from one end of the world to the other, modeled on basically a European
you know, a Germanic Jewish guy who is an exile in England, and his best friend, who is from a millionaire industrial family originally from Germany, living in London, and they basically were like two college couples, them and their wives, and they thought up, basically the four of them thought it all up. You know, the whole thing we call socialism and communism and all our progressive was thought up by two young couples, you know, who were pretty brilliant. They spoke a lot of languages, that's for sure. And that was adopted by, you know, countries who today might call third world. I don't use that term so much anymore, but it's a handy word, I guess. All the poorer countries in the world, that had these movements. Steph, it was amazing, you know, that all over the world, people did look to that. And so I think that.
Because they control the narrative.
Yeah, but people, you know, smart people, you know, I can name very smart people in African society. I think even in Namibia, too, that upheld these. I think it's Namibia that has the AK-47 in its flag.
That's right. Well, guys, since it's Russian New Year's Eve, right.
What I'm prospering here is that the only people who benefited from that whole European trip are Europeans. And that even though today we attribute the rise of China out of poverty to taking on the capitalist system.
No, it's not. I don't think they're really. That's the problem, is you can call yourself anything. Doesn't mean that's what you are. I mean, you can see it be a Democrat or freedom lover. You can. Oh, there's so many things. People call themselves in this society on the internet anything they feel like. They have all kinds of weird identities on the internet, and it doesn't mean anything.
It's not the point that I'm making, Paul. The point that I'm making is that if we consider in the glorification of only one part of the world, mm-hmm. we have little knowledge of other histories.
That's for sure.
And at point, when we go to default, it's always the part of the world that was clever enough to take the scientific inventions of other cultures, weaponize them, and then
absolutely, you got a point.
Population,
absolutely,
and take all the resources of the world, mm-hmm. and then pollute the rest.
Absolutely, unfortunately, you're very true. What you're saying is very true.
Well, guys, that'll
get me on the subway. What I'm trying to get to is, when are we going to move off of slaughter and conquer to get what you want and move on to sanity? We have the ability to do that. We have the technical tools to do that. And even when I was talking to Mr. Dix earlier, I pointed out spike protein. He pointed out polio vaccine. The current shots aren't based on the traditional vaccine model. So therefore, they're not vaccines. They are a treatment. They may be an effective treatment for what they were developed for, which is to reduce symptoms and reduce hospitalization. You still have 20 to 40% of the people in hospital who've been fully vaccinated, fully boosted, but nobody's talking about the main thing. You have an immune system. How does it work? Who's going to build it for you? What do you do to keep it healthy? If you have quote-unquote comorbidities, that means if you're already dead, but you're still walking around, what are they? Simple things like that change the tone and the tenor of how we look at what we need to do, which is to live a life of love.
Right.
I can say this much, since it's Russian New Year's Eve. Many years ago, I was working up in Syracuse for a week, and I went up to a place called Lorraine, New York, which I knew was in my family's legacy when we came from Europe before the First World War.
Sure.
So I went up, and I see this lady working in the front of this farm, and I pull up, and I say, "Hi, do you know where this is such and such farm?" She goes, "You don't remember your aunt? She was the first woman to work as an engineer at General Electric in Syracuse, right?" We got to talk, and I'm about to leave, you know, go back to work. A great visit with my relatives. And then she says to me, "Go to this cemetery on the other side of Route 81. I want you to go there. I said, why should I do that? That's where your great-grandparents are buried. My great-grandparents? What? I had no idea. So I went there. I then looked into the legacy, got all these books. My great-great-grandparents were born as serfs in Europe.
What part of Europe were they, the serfs?
Well, we were, one side of the mountains was in Austro-Hungary. The other side was Tsarist Russia. We were serfs for 500 freaking years.
Wow.
Literally, the ones in Austro-Hungary were freed in 1848. The rest of us were 1861.
Right, that's when they freed them. Russia freed the serfs in 1861.
Well, let's do a happy ending, though. Something horrible happened 100 years ago. When my great-grandfather was up there and the other family members who were dairy farmers, one night on his front lawn, now this is the Polish side of the family, Polish Catholics,
mm-hmm.
a cross was burnt on their front lawn.
Where?
This is in upstate New York.
In upstate New York. Oh, that's sick. Why? Because they were Polish? Because they were Polish? Okay.
No, Catholic.
Because they were Catholic and they were immigrants.
Did you see that special? I think it was on America Experience where they just uncovered a mass grave of several hundred Irish Catholic railroad workers who were murdered. They were camping out next to the job, and some people from a Pennsylvania English village came over the hill and murdered them all.
Oh, God.
150 people, and then put them in a dump in a mass grave, and nobody ever investigated it till like American Experience did like a few years ago?
Well, guys, here's the thing. For me, I've always been interested in history. The 20s, there was the revival of the Klan against poor black folk and all the recent immigrants. So here we are. They burned the cross on my grandfather's front lawn, right? And at that point, the farms were all close together. What they didn't realize is that my great-grandfather had served in the Tsar's army.
No.
Okay, here's
I know. The same thing. You know what's funny? My grandfather had served
in
get to it, but it's funny that you're saying this story. I hear where it's heading. Go ahead.
Well, the guys all got together. Great-uncle Gregory, who was in the Tsar's cavalry, all this. They got together, and they knew how to track. And happy ending, guys. They found the gentleman who burnt the cross, and they talked to them, shall we say. There was no cross burnings there for a while.
But
as our family says, they were able to do that because we were pale faces. The black families in Watertown that also had crosses burnt, they couldn't do a thing about it because of the situation in the world at that point. So
I think they described that in a couple of episodes of Boardwalk Empire. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, they show that, right?
They shoot him, yeah.
Right. Chalky, right, is the kid. There's a guy, as tough as he is, you know, that's not that tough. You know,
they pull up on a Klan rally, and they say, who are you, jokers? And they shoot two of the Klan guys, and they're laying there. And he goes, now that we have your attention. But the thing is, this is something in my family I never knew about, right?
Right.
And it's like...
Do you think anybody want to talk about that? Because you could make it so well in America if you just don't rock the boat.
But my ancestors, my grandparents said that we could fight back. Where the black families who lived in Watertown, the big town, who worked in the mill, they couldn't fight back. Otherwise, they would be, you know what?
My grandfather was in the Italian army and. They were living on Delphi Street, where the right by the Navy Yard, right? He bought a burnt out house and fixed it because he had all these carpentry skills, and he had been in the Carabinieri, which is like the special forces, and all that. And a lot of my family members in Italy had fought in all these horrible battles up in the Alps against the Austrians and the Germans and all this stuff. And there was some drunk neighbors who were harassing my aunts. We're like now in their 90s, but we're coming home from school in the 1930s, and they were like seriously harassing them. And this was going on and on and on, and they were really drunk, this next door family. And it got to the point where my grandfather just had it up to here. And my dad always told me he was like 6 years old, and he never in his life ever saw my grandfather angry. He never raised his voice, never had anything but a smiling countenance on his face. He was like, every picture of him has a big smile on his face. You would see the sweetest, nicest guy in the world. And my dad's like playing with some toys in the front yard they had behind a fence. And he comes out of down the stoop of the building they owned and rented the top floors and stuff. And he comes out and he, in a rage, like with, he'd never seen him look that way before in his face. And he walked past
my dad and out the swinging gate, and my dad said I saw a pistol in his back pocket.
Whoops.
I know. And he went out there, and he said he could hear the screaming. The drunk neighbors were screaming. My grandfather was screaming. And then there was silence. And then my grandfather came back, and they never talked to those neighbors again.
Wow.
They acted like they weren't even there, and they acted like my family wasn't there, and they just ignored each other. I had a discussion about this with the district attorney of Brooklyn, because I was interviewing him about a gun buyback, about the weird ways that people come into possession of guns. And he said the same thing happened in his family, even though he's a friggin' DA, and it was a big hassle getting rid of that gun from the 1930s. It was a hassle for the DA. He said it was a big hassle.
I can say that over the years, some of my cousins who were very successful, and yeah, they're Republicans, I can't believe it, and they would start saying stupid things at family gatherings. And I would say, hey, guys, Great Uncle Gregory and Great Grandpa, we had a cross burned on our front lawn in 1922. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How does that feel? And they're like, you're kidding. No, it's all documented. It was actually in the local newspaper. And all of a sudden, you know, these well-to-do yuppie Republicans, maybe not so nice to certain minority groups, but felt like,
like
us too.
Places like West Virginia. I actually like West Virginia, and I like the people. I've met a lot of the people there. I don't agree with their politics, but I love their sort of – they love music. They like to eat and party, and they're nice people. They're, like, pleasant, I guess, if you're just not the wrong person, right? I was able to pass with them or whatever. I don't know what it is, but I get along fine down there. But I remember – you know, you're reminding me of family things, like – we went on a family trip, and we were driving. My mom kept saying to my dad, don't drive through West Virginia. Don't drive through West Virginia. And my dad said, oh, there's no problem with West Virginia. Forget it. And we drove through, and there was a four-way stop. And I was sitting in the back seat, and I hear my mom screech, like, ah, he's pointing at our license plate. And sure enough, I look out the window, and there's a guy in a pickup truck with a rifle rack pointing at her license plate.
Oh, God.
And she just yelled at my dad, hit, go through the stop sign. And he slammed on the gas, and we took flying out of that town at 100 miles an hour.
Well, this, if I may bring everybody together, I live 40 miles from Manhattan. I moved back to where I grew up last year with all the COVID crazy stuff. Our town, so many people in the town, and we moved from Jersey City in 1962. 1965, there was a very well-to-do neighborhood on the lake here that was actually not gated, but it was restricted. And I didn't know what that meant, right? So in 1965, President Johnson signed the law, the Civil Rights Act, and the well-to-do people in town were furious. That commie Johnson, oh, wow, this, this, and that. And they put in the local paper, guys, and all the WAI listeners, it was restricted, and on the deed, it says we forbid the following people from living here: Negroes, Roman Catholics, and Jews. This is in our lifetimes, 40 miles from freaking Manhattan.
I think that was true in on Long Island when they built after the war, when they built Levittown, right?
Yeah.
And that's how Trump and his father, you know, Fred Trump, made their money. They were in the same business as Levitt.
And it's like,
I remember. No, they had no black people allowed in Levittown. I don't know. Has that changed at all?
Well, of course it's changed. But
if you go to Levittown, is it all white or is still? Or what?
I don't know. But I live in New Jersey, foreign country. But the idea is that
I think it hasn't changed that much. I don't know.
But all these affluent communities in northwestern New Jersey, they have this in their deed, for crying out loud.
They still have them in the deeds, even though it's illegal. They're still in the deeds.
I mean, my God! And as kids,
I grew up in Yonkers, so it's no surprise to me. I grew up in a nightmare. Our mayor was found dead with a bullet in his head on the grave of his father in the midst of a fight over scatter site housing. You know, so my hometown, we know. I mean, I went to the city council of the Yonkers City Council in '89, and I never saw anything like that before in my life. I've never seen anything like that in New York City. I never wanted to go home again after that. It was horrifying.
Well, the legacy of these communities, we had in our Democratic Club in town, some well-to-do people moved into that that area. And it's a beautiful place, I gotta say. And one time they were espousing about the world and all this and blah, blah, blah. And they said, what do you mean? That fancy house you got in the lake? Well, guess what? 1965, you couldn't live there, pal. Don't you know anything about the history where you live? Oh, well, that's them.
So what are we going to do about all this? I mean, okay, great. We're enlightened white people who know, you know, the horrors that our compatriots have delivered upon the other in this whole history of this country, and it's horrifying. It's horrifying to be part of it. I mean, you know, it's screwed up my life in the sense of, like, here I am at BAI, like, with no money, you know, living on, like, a wisp and a prayer because I don't want to have anything to do with it. Ever since Vietnam, it's horrifying to me. I look at people who seem so happy in America, you know, making money and having a career and doing this and raising their families, and I just want to vomit.
Well, I am happy. I am grateful that my family came here before the First World War, because when they lived in Europe, that's where the big battles were on the Eastern Front. So I'm grateful for the opportunity
right.
and all that. But the history going back is like...
But that doesn't put a lie on it, because they say we came to America for all these other reasons, but the real reason, time and time again, is to escape the possibility of war.
The reason why our family is here, because they wanted guys to work in a coal mine 12 hours a day or a steel mill. That's why they brought us over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And no ifs, buts, or ands about it. And they admit it, yeah.
Or put on roofs. I think my grandfather
put on
roofs.
Or
May
roofs.
I interject? Whatever.
Roofer.
May
yeah.
I interject?
Yeah, go ahead. Go.
Teach the history. You need to teach all of it.
That's right.
We talk about the quote-unquote minorities, but... Look at what they did to, like, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name. My name is Daryl.
Hey,
look
Darryl,
at what
I'm
they
Brett.
Did to the people of European descent who came here. First,
the Irish?
All of them.
Well, they,
Irish
it's different. It's hard. Well, Europe is not monolithic. It's a weird place. I mean,
but it is the center of war and death
absolutely.
For millions of people.
Well, parts of it are, yeah. Parts
and
of it
it's
are.
It's all based on there's not enough, and we have to get ours before anybody gets anything.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. If you taught the history of how the deprivation moved from one continent to the other, then they tell us, well, there was nobody here, except for the 10 million people who were here that we had to get rid of. You just talked about land-grant colleges. Whose land? Who granted it? Did they have the right to grant it?
I'm no, absolutely not.
People bring up 1863, right? January 1st. What is that? Oh, that's the day Lincoln freed the slaves. Garbage. Nonsense.
And they didn't even have a veterinary school at the University of Wisconsin for years. No, it's nothing to laugh about, because it's supposed to be a land-grant college, like he's saying. They took the land from the Indians, and they didn't even have a how to take care of your farm animals school.
Once again, it's something that needs to be taught. But if Europeans understood their own history here, how in grades, as the Anglo-Saxon needed more people, they let other people from Europe become white. Because there's a difference between
yeah,
being
you got
European
a point there. Yep.
And becoming white. And you don't get in the club until they need you.
Who decided it? Nobody can tell me who decided it.
That's not true.
No, I see the paper. If you go on the internet and look up any page from the manifests that are on the website for Ellis Island, and they have every manifest of all the millions of people who came through Ellis Island, white European, European immigrants. And everyone is like robotically under race. They have the race of everybody. And underneath robotically, they wrote page after page. Somebody in the same handwriting just like, you know, rhythmically wrote white, next page, white. And
yeah,
why did they judge all these people as
that
white?
That doesn't mean you get in the club.
Yeah, they weren't really that white.
You don't get in the club until they actually need you as a vote or for some other reason.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the progression, right? First, it was only people from England. Then, begrudgingly, they let in. I'm trying to think of who was next. I think they let the Germans in before they let in the Irish.
Well, the Irish came as Irish people, and there's other people who can tell us more about it, but they came in as refugees from the horrifying famine that occurred there in the 1840s.
It wasn't a famine.
Well, it could have been genocide, right? I leave it at the basic thing and then let the callers call and tell me more about it. I understand there's some who believe it was purposely done.
Well, that's the point. If we teach the history and get people to understand what is actually going on here, then perhaps we can change what's going on here and then get forgiveness from the rest of the world for screwing things up as deeply as it had. Because
well, that's why I had Carl on. Carl had some good ideas. I don't agree with everything. But, I actually would – the adventure of tearing down this horrifying system that has failed us so desperately for decades and rebuilding a new one to replace it at the exact same time would be the greatest adventure of human – of our history. It would be a wonderful thing to try and do. It would be difficult for sure. But, what does NASA say? We try difficult things.
In fairness to our Anglo-Saxon cousins and brothers, if you will, a lot of them came over as indentured servants, like you're saying. That they were poor and they were distressed, too. In 1850, at the height of the Queen Victoria, the big crime family, if you will, the British royal family, an industrial worker in Manchester, average lifespan was 38 years. I mean, the oppression thing of people coming over. Yeah, and then when they leave us, okay, yeah, we'll be nice to you, give you a dollar a day, and you'll be in the company store, you know, owing them forever. And every succession.
Considering my grandfather would say, like everybody told him, there's going to be another war, you better get the hell out of here. You're 18 years old, and, you barely scooted through the last war without being drafted, and the next one's coming. Get the hell out. And he did. And he came, and he hated it. He came here, and he said, he came to the Lower East Side, and he said they would never, they didn't allow buildings like that with newspapers. You ever been involved in demo work in a Lower East Side or an old New York apartment, and you rip down the wall, and you find all the 1920s newspapers shoved back in there so that they could insulate the building, and you wonder, like, oh, my God, this whole building is like a giant fire trap. It's filled with newspaper in between the walls for his, in those days, a cast iron stove in the middle of the room with people throwing wood in it and 20 guys sleeping on the floor. He said that was pretty unbelievable when he came off the boat. He moved, he moved to Yorkville up on the Upper East Side?
Uptown,
yeah. That was the Hungarian German neighborhood at the time. And that was a step up. That was a big step up. And then from there to the Bronx, which was huge. The North Bronx was a major step up. And then they finally wound up in, it's a typical story, right? They wound up in Yonkers. Where else?
The point being, if you want to change the society, the fastest way with the technology available is to bring mental health to this country, which is, for some reason, is an anathema. Because when I was talking to Mr. Dix, right, what kind of revolutionary communist party accept mainstream capitalist cures for disease and pushes it and gets indignant when you challenge? It's insane. It doesn't make any sense. You start with the individual. If you notice, especially during this pandemic thing, it's the individual's fault that the society is having this problem. If only the individuals would behave, then everything would be okay. Okay, so what is considered behavior? Doing what I say. Does what you say make sense? Does it matter? I can convince enough people that it makes sense, so do you need to do what I say? And if you don't do it, then we're going to make you do it. What does that sound like to you, Paul? It sounds like fascism. It is fascism. I've lived in this country for on and off, taking off my military service, 73 years. I've yet to see, a fair and free election, which wasn't even possible until 1967, 68. And still, to this day, you have purging. You have New York City was under the Voters' Rights Act until the Supreme Court changed it, right? Yeah. All right.
Yonkers was, that's for sure. Mississippi. Hey, somebody from Mississippi once said to me.
How do you change the individual's thinking, right? You give them education and you give them tools to deal with their fear, because right now everybody's in terror. So they're pretending that they care about the spread of a disease while they're acting like there's no disease out there, right? 2 years in, where are the N95 masks? How come you're still testing with tests that don't work? Why aren't you?
I have a counterfeit one. I looked at my, after I saw what a real N95 was, I looked at mine and it does not have the NIKOSH stamp on it, which means it's a fake.
Come on, Paul. Pick out $1.50. You can get $1.
I know. But, you know, I get a bunch of them. I had no idea what a fake one was until I saw it on TV. And then I looked at mine and I said, these are all fake.
Okay, where did you buy it?
I forget. I don't know. I have boxes of them. I have all kinds of, you know, it's one of several boxes of them I have stashed away.
If it isn't 3M or if it isn't filtered, FLTR,
yeah,
more than likely you ain't getting what you want.
Yeah, you gotta, it has to say NICOSH stamped on it.
And it should be a number on it also.
Yeah. Okay, well, the next round, I'll buy the real ones.
If we were willing to educate the population fully in important things, products that they actually offer on WBAI, entrainment therapy, so that you can deal with your fears, so that you can become rational when you think, so that you can weigh all the possibilities, no matter, quote-unquote, how dark and how strange it is. We have the tools to make people mentally very strong, physically very healthy, right? You go in a supermarket, 90% of the food is going to kill you. Why is that? What's
slowly.
The point?
Because they said it will kill you, but they didn't say when. It's basically how people think of it.
Well, it's about money. They don't want you dead. They're like a virus.
They just keep you alive, barely.
So that you can take medicine that they can then profit from.
Horrifying. I would rather die than take medicine.
Well, you don't have, in most instances, whatever condition you have.
I'm sure there's cure, but my friend has been kept alive for 10 years after a massive coronary, and he's doing great. So, you know, he takes a lot of pills every day. You know, he took a lot of pills every day. But at the same time, when I see the scam involved in it, I just don't want to participate in such a thing.
And you don't have to. Talk to Dr. Kakai as an example. You know? Yeah. I mean, Gary is insane as he is on something. I mean, the guy cured acquired immune deficiency syndrome when everybody else was crying and wringing their hands. And what did he get for it? He's a denier. Right? I mean...
He helped a lot of people. I used to work for him. He helped a lot of people. I saw them coming. We have somebody new on the line. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Daryl, you make a lot of sense. You're the most lucid caller I ever heard on this program, or many others. And I wanted to speak to some of the things you said. I don't want to turn this into a virus program, but basically...
That seems to be what everybody wants to talk about.
Well, but, you know, what Daryl said about immunity is very important, and nobody's talking about it. I'm writing a pamphlet right now, but I'm willing to discuss my ideas here as well. You know, in the 2 years, you know, Paul, where I live, I'm at this epicenter of the pandemic. I've been to places that have been talked about in the papers as hotspots at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. People who were with me died. The reason we are here today is that our ancestors were naturally immune to smallpox, black plague, because otherwise we wouldn't be here today. So what I'm positing is that by evidence I didn't want to gather, it just happened to me, I know that I am immune to this. And people in the so-called healthcare community should not only be aware of the comorbidities, as Daryl said, but they should study people like me, because there may be something there that could help the larger population. But nobody's talking about this. You know why? Because there is no money in people who are healthy. if you are not sick and if you're not dependent, whether it's psychologically or in the real world, on things that keep you healthy, nobody makes any money. Or, you know, the people who control the healthcare industry do not make any money. Now, I'm not saying that the whole thing is a conspiracy, but it is the way
it's the system. Sante, it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. The system.
No, it's not necessarily a conspiracy. But
the capitalist system makes everything seem like a conspiracy, but it's really the so-called invisible hand of profit, you know, making everybody act the same way.
Well, but, you know, it's the politicians who are running scared, and they want to be seen as doing something that will get them reelected, to help people, whatever. And the pharmaceutical companies were making out like bandits, using this fear and saying, okay, you want a remedy? Here it is. It just costs, you know, however many billion dollars that you have to give us in perpetuity, because after shot number three, they already talked about number fourth, and it's going to be in every 6 months or every year.
Yeah, like the flu.
Yeah, exactly.
Like flu, another one.
Have you ever taken a flu vaccine? I haven't.
Yeah, I had to. You know, I was a teacher. They didn't. My first day on the job at a public school in the South Bronx, you know, you're not allowed to, if you're a teacher, to get treated by the school nurse, right? There's a union rule about that. You know, the school nurse is only allowed to treat students, not teachers. So you never can go to the school nurse if you get sick if you're a teacher. You have to go to a doctor or leave or whatever. And they said, all of a sudden over the PA, they announced, we have one shot of the flu vaccine left, and we're going to raffle it off. And we will announce the winner of the raffle. And this is my first day on the job, and everybody knew it was my first day, right? And later that afternoon, we have the winner of the raffle. Paul DiRienzo, please go to the nurse's room. And I go there, and she's waiting for me, and she goes, here you go, bam. And basically, back then there was no mandate, but you ain't working here if you don't get a shot. You know, nobody's going to work with you. They're not going to let you in the building if you don't get a shot.
See, like you and everybody else who grew up in the time we did, I got plenty of vaccines. I'm not against vaccines per se, but as Daryl said, this is not a vaccine. This is not the thing that they put in our system with a weakened pathogen that our system would learn to fight. This is something that alters your RNA, which is the molecule that tells your DNA what to build. I did study these things in school, and I was paying attention in class, and that's why I remember. And this is a different thing. Now, it can be a remedy if you have such a depleted immunitary system, if you have conditions whereby you cannot fight this bug on your own. And absolutely, if I had evidence that this would be me tomorrow, because I know that immunity changes. It's not that I have a shield around me, and I don't behave stupidly. I put on a mask wherever I have to. I am very careful of other people. Even when I don't have to, if I see a crowd, I have to go through them, I put on a mask. It's simple, you know.
It's required, yeah. But, you know, if you do that at a Walmart in West Virginia, you get a lot of dirty looks, man. Serious dirty looks, man. And I really couldn't understand, why does wearing a mask in a place that actually does have a mask mandate in Walmart, so you have to wear the mask, and there's some people who are just denying it, who refuse to wear it, and they just walk around without it. And they look at me like, I'm the one who's following the rules, asshole. I mean, you know.
Exactly, but it's not just a matter of rules. It's, again, like Daryl says, is use your head. You know, what makes sense? We've been trained by the Western media years and years back to see these poor Asian people, you know, in Tokyo, in Beijing, they have to put on the mask because the air is so polluted there. Crap! The reason they have the masks on is that they don't want your microbes. And finally, the penny's dropping.
There you go. Why do people who are so, like, anti, you know, intimate behavior and anti-gay or whatever, they're anti-everything, are willing to breathe in each other's spit?
Right, and you know,
that's what they're doing.
Yeah,
you know, we've been doing
it.
They
don't know any better, Paul.
We've always done it. In Japan, they knew. They didn't need COVID to wear masks.
They don't know it here.
Yeah.
They don't know it here.
They're learning it.
We're like breathing in. Everybody's on the subway. We're all breathing in each other's friggin' spit. It's disgusting.
That's the way to get immunity.
I never thought of it. Yeah, but it's still disgusting.
Way to get immunity.
Yeah, it's still disgusting.
Yeah, well,
Gary doesn't ride the subway for that very reason. I can tell you that.
humans are the body part of the human is pretty strange.
It's pretty strange. You're like crawling with all. I think they say there's so many bacteria and viruses growing on the outside of every human being that it really the DNA of the viruses and of our bodies merge. And it's true. And that actually. Yeah, that's why cancer is.
You're symbiotic.
Yeah, but that's why cancer is so hard to cure.
A different DNA than the human part of that body.
Right. Well, that's why cancer is so hard to. Possibly one of the reasons why cancer is so hard to cure, because it's not. You can't just find the genetics of the cancer in your body, but also the effect of the bio. Known by biome,
around,
you know, all over your skin and everything too has a lot to do with it.
However, Paul, that's not true. Cancer isn't all that hard to cure if you're willing to make the changes to do the cure. No, we want to keep eating the crap and get a magic pill so that we can continue to abuse the body.
Radium.
You have to get healthy mind, spirit. Mind and body, and the way that you get the body in line is first you get control of the mind. Mm-hmm. You
Daryl,
are a spirit.
Speaking to that,
you
Daryl, I also think that one, and it's not just my thinking, and you know, even Gary Noll and people like him talk about this. One big factor in autoimmunity diseases, which cancer is stress, and people don't talk about that. I know people. Healthy people who eat well, who do sports, and they're so stressed out. One, in fact, was my partner. She got cancer simply because of the unhealthy working life that she had that colored her entire psychology. And she was permanently stressed, and she eventually got cancer. Thank God it was a minor thing. It got taken out, and as far as I know, there is no reoccurrence. But that, to me, was living proof. And not just that. I know other people as well who have gotten it. I don't know their life as well as I knew my ex-partners, but I can tell the factor of stress in their lives is so enormous that eventually it's going to take an impact on your immunity system, and it's not going to make you able to fight all the things that we are not even aware that we fight every day. Because they're in the air, they're in the water, they're in the things we eat, even if we eat healthily. I mean, if you eat an aubergine, an eggplant, the eggplant has got natural poisons. That's why, Paul, you probably remember your grandmother, as my mother and grandmother did. They put salt on the aubergine before they cooked it, and they let it stay overnight so that all the liquid would come out. I still do that.
My mom did it. She called, you know, she's Eastern European. She called it koshering. You koshered the food.
Well, the reason that the aubergine has that is to defend itself from animals that might want to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even natural things have things that are not very good for us. So when you start living in a stressful lifestyle, which unfortunately, you know, for factors that cannot be controlled, many people have in their lives, I'd say the overwhelming majority, you are undermining your best resource to fight any kind of disease.
And that's why I'm saying, if you do the entrainment therapy, if you do the things that help you deal with that stress, we produce cancers all the time.
It's you know, my great thing is this, and I'm no 12-stepper, but I have barely had a drink in 2.5 years.
That's good, but we know what your other hobby is.
No, alcohol was my hobby, but I decided not to drink because I didn't want to be stuck at home drinking. I thought it was the worst thing in the world, you know, and so I stopped it. And, you know, occasionally I had a glass of wine with somebody or this or that, but basically I barely had a drink in 2.5 years.
Yes, but Daryl, finish your thought. It was very interesting. Go on.
All right, so if you do the entrainment therapy and you remove all the fears that are inculcated into us, the training that's that we learn from the preborn to about 9 years old. That's where you develop most of your fears from. And if you remove that and put in healthy thoughts, good practices,
and then you stay with that, all the stress that you encounter during your life is A, of choice, and can be handled. Because if you're under stress, negative stress, it's because you're fearful that you won't be able to feed yourself, clothe yourself, or house yourself without doing whatever's causing you distress. Or you're living in a society that's totally insane, which I've been living in for 73 years, and it's pretty much hopeless. So if you don't do that, you end up either medicating yourself with legal pharmaceuticals or illegal pharmaceuticals. The idea is the whole population needs to cleanse itself. A, it needs to come to the realization that there's a problem, and the problem is the self. Not the self in relationship to the society, but the self in relationship to what we were given as how things work. And then we need to work things the way they are. Currently, the population on the planet is producing sufficient wealth to both feed, clothe, and house everybody on the planet the way it is, and begin to reduce the damage that has been done by the Third Industrial Revolution. That's just fact. $36 billion in one day, Elon Musk made that about 2 weeks ago. He made $9 billion yesterday.
On paper.
What is the problem? You got 80 billionaires living in New York City, and we're running around saying, oh, we don't have any housing for people. How can we have a medical care system? Oh, if you want to do away with Rikers Island, stop producing criminals. You have the technology to do that. Remote learning. I've never seen such a big joke in my whole life as, oh, the children are so damaged by not going to school. Hello. Pretend you're in space. How are you going to teach your kids? Mm. Right? Remote learning, if people don't have, first of all, the tools to do the job, like a sufficient Wi-Fi, sufficient hardware and software, that's the first thing. But beyond that, why not hire more teachers to go into the home to help the children? Oh, we don't have money for that. Well, why? You got 80 billionaires living in this city. They can't kick up a couple of hundred million apiece to hire some teachers? I mean, you know, at point it becomes laughable about what we expect.
You have to take into account another thing as well, Daryl, because unfortunately, you could hire all the teachers in the world. If the philosophy of teaching that you're following is screwed up, you're just going to just be pounding the round peg into the square hole that much harder. I mean, the problem I don't see the change coming down the line, but this whole testing regimen is the worst thing in the world. Horrifying.
You can pull out any time you're ready. All you need to do is, A, educate the population to the ignorance and the waste.
That's
of
what
money.
I would rather say. Teach people how to think critically, which is in education school, when you're getting a degree to be a teacher, they keep telling you all these great idealistic ideas. Read the pedagogy of the oppressed. You know, you can use all these progressive means to engage students. And then when you get to the job, all they are is drill, 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 drill. No critical thinking. If you try and teach critical thinking, they think you're crazy. Good way to wind up out on your butt in the street without a job. They don't like it. And yet everybody says that the problem, the reason why so many people believe in QAnon and all that stuff is the lack of proper training in how to think critically.
And if you try to do something different, and you know for sure, they say, where are your test results? They judge you because they review your performance, and they say, oh, this teacher's testing scores are very low. He must not be a good teacher.
Yeah, they will take into account how many times they lie and jack up the scores and they're not honest.
Did you hear David Banks on the radio this morning?
No, but what did he talk about, that kind of stuff?
He said 65% of the population in the New York City public schools is graduating unqualified to do anything.
Yeah, I could have. But the thing is that what do they mean by qualified? I mean,
what they're talking about is the ability to read, write, and do.
You know what's more important than then is thinking critically, because too much of the reading is phonics. They're just trying to get you to sound out the words and make believe you can read. There's no actual effort spent on truly identifying what you're reading.
I'm agreeing with your personal experience. What I'm saying is that if we have any hope to save this thing without going into a really ugly period of civil war, which it appears that, you know, this is another piece. I just got to throw this in before I finish that thought. According to the census, 66% of the population is identifying as white. Is that the way it lists on the census?
Really? But it's going down. It's way going down. It's already at under at school age. It's already more than 50% people of color.
No, not in New York City. I'm talking about in the country.
Well, I think in the country. I think
forget New York City. New York City is like off and away, and some really revolutionary things can happen here if we could keep the capital in the city. And if we use the capital to improve the city. Once again, you got 80 billionaires living in this city. Let them form a Davos of their own and improve this city. I don't understand what the thought pattern is of a society that says it's operating on, what do they call the economy? A spending economy, on a consumer economy, in which it denies the consumers the capital that they need in order to consume.
Here's the population of the U.S. by race. As of 2020, white Americans are the racial and ethnic majority, representing 57.8% of the population. That's way down, right? Hispanic and Latino Americans, who may belong to any racial group, are the largest ethnic minority, comprising 18.7% of the population, while black or African Americans are the largest racial minority, making up 12.1%.
Okay, so how was it my fault? At 12%, how was it my fault?
It's pretty steady.
You can do whatever you want. Carl, you can do whatever you want. You got 57% off the top. You can do whatever you want. So if someone's oppressing you, it ain't about critical race theory. It ain't about somebody taking my job, because I don't have the job to give you. So if I get your job, quote unquote, I got it from another white person. So the battle, once again, comes from Europe to the continent of the United States, in which it just replicates itself.
I have something to interject, if I may. I don't think it's necessarily and only racially based. It's equal opportunity rapaciousness, because, you know, I've been in a situation, being Italian, but again, after the big purge, being identified as white, and still when I arrived here in the early 1980s, end of the 70s, Italy meant mafia, and then gradually became something else. Now it's glamorous to be Italian, right? Because you have the fashion and all that crap. But,
I thoroughly agree with you. You didn't get white status. You probably were seen more favorably than Paul, who was born here.
Possibly, because of my
accent. I had to deal, the white ethnic groups do not get along very well. Believe it or not, that's the hidden reality that white people don't tell you is that various different ethnic groups of white people have murderous intent on each other, equal to the general feeling between black and white. And
that's the point that I'm making.
I grew up in that, and you had to know how to fight. Believe me.
Yeah. Were you in a German neighborhood or what?
I don't want to go into it because I'm really good friends with that ethnic group now. But back then I wasn't. Back then I had to fight all the time with people from that certain ethnic group, and they didn't like Italians very much, and it was a lot of fisticuffs. Believe me.
But you see, the basic thing is that capital doesn't care about the color of your skin as long as you can be a good cog in the machine. And if you don't work well, you can be replaced regardless of your race, regardless of your ethnic background. capitalism doesn't care. And, you know, I have had direct experience of that. If you don't conform to the system, you're out of the system. And possibly, I was reflecting on this yesterday, my life is completely stress-free. It's because I chose to be out of it. You know, I don't care how much money I make. I have a rent-stabilized apartment, which will probably be never taken care out of my behind. And that's a big guarantee. I don't need to make a lot of money. I work, you know, when I manage to work, I will probably be unemployed for the rest of my life. I say that I'm realizing the American dream because of the pandemic. I'm going to go directly from unemployment to Social Security in a few years, not even. But regardless, I don't need that much money to live. But I still have the kind of life that I want, intellectually stimulating. You can go to art galleries that are free. You can go to the public library, which is an amazing institution. The one time I had extra money for a contribution, I gave it to the New York Public Library because it deserves it. And it has a fascinating history. You should go and read it if you don't know it, because it's not just all the patrons. It started from when it became a lending library. It was a women's sewing circle. And they were not very erudite. One of them said, these books that you're bringing are crap. And she started bringing better books, and they started to loan them to themselves. And that became part of what today is the Ottendorfer branch. It was downtown. And eventually became the New York Public Library like it is today.
Mm-hmm. But I borrowed books from that library. I like that branch. I love that building.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing building.
Right next to the St. Mark's Place.
And that was the German community, by the way.
Right. Little Deutschland. Kleine Deutschland.
Exactly. And, you know, interesting.
You know the story about the ship that sank, right? The General Slocum.
Yeah, the General Brooks. First address in New York was next door to the church, which is now a synagogue.
Right. That was the largest loss of life from an accident in New York City history until 9/11.
It was well over 1,000 kids.
Mostly children, yeah.
And their chaperones.
Horrifying. That's how, because they couldn't live there anymore, and they moved up to Yorktown and out to New Jersey, Yorkville and out to New Jersey, and that's why those areas are the German areas. The German people couldn't stand to come back to their homes after that tragedy, and they moved to Jersey and to uptown New York, uptown Manhattan.
Well, if you can just imagine that they sold the church to a synagogue, you know.
Right. Well, we're talking about liberal Germans here. The ones you're referring to, the Axis Germans, are a little different.
They didn't care, you know. Yeah. They just wanted to be out of there.
The Axis Germans are shows that temporary insanity can take over a whole country, so America better beware. That's what I'm saying.
Where did they get the model from, Paul?
The Nazis? They sort of made it up, I think, as they went along.
No, Paul, come on.
What do you mean? What do you mean by the model?
The United States.
Oh, yeah, for, like, concentration camps. Yeah, and also South Africa, too. Yeah. Well, America first.
Later. You know, the apartheid in South Africa started later on.
But why the association, over and over again, the association of left-wingers and fascists? I can tell you that the America First movement was a fascist creation of people like Lindbergh, but it had a lot of secret leftist members.
Well, because I'm speculating here, maybe they thought there was a good chance to make a revolution.
It's anti-government, and it was a place where you could hide out with a bunch of other anti-government people, and nobody would know.
Also, good cover. You're right.
Yeah, it's good cover. It is.
Do you know the Italian writer Curzio Malaparte, Paul? He wrote a couple of very interesting books. One is called Technique of the Coup d'Etat, which, this guy was all over the place in the political spectrum. He started as an anarchist, then he went into the fascist party. Then when he wrote this book, not only was he banned by Mussolini, he was arrested and then confined to an island because he didn't say very flattering things about Hitler. But he basically analyzed the Russian Revolution and how Trotsky went to the nuts and bolts of seizing power, and it's a fascinating book. Not that I'm trying to or planning to replicate it.
Why not?
You know,
it's about time.
Sorry?
It's about time somebody replicated it.
Well, what basically, you know, the thesis is, if you have a good organization, all you need is 1,000 people to take over a city like St. Petersburg, divided in teams of 3 or 4, each one with a machine gun. You put them in the ganglia, which then were the telephone company and the electrical company and the gas company and various other, and, you know, the main intersection.
Lenin was running the whole show from the Smolny Institute.
That's right.
I read 10 Days That Shook the World. That's why I know that.
Yes, but this book is better. I strongly recommend it, and it has been translated into English as well.
Good. Wow, cool. I mean, always interested in books about history, good books about the history of that period of time, and so how it came to be, how people could go crazy. One of my favorite books about Germany in that period is one was a play called Love Letters to Hitler, which was pretty interesting, but this one was tourist letters and postcards that were sent home from tour groups that went to Germany in the 30s, which was throughout the 30s still a place, one of the most popular places for tour groups, student tour groups to go, especially at the end of the year from the United States and different countries, and because of the culture that was represented by Beethoven and all that stuff, and Mozart and what have you. And so people were going to Germany, and they would write letters back, postcards and letters about what it was like. And this book is a collection of those postcards. And what
it just came out, right?
Yeah. I got it out of the library. I couldn't believe I was reading through it. It was unbelievable. The most interesting to me was high school kids are unguarded. So high school kids would I hate this. This is horrifying. But the majority of people loved Germany and thought it was amazing. You could eat off the street. Nobody broke the law. Law and order was the king. And there was no disturbances or anything anywhere. Everybody was walking around in spit and polish and uniforms and was super polite. But then they would say, well, you know, the Jews are always troublemakers anyway. So, they brought it upon themselves. And you can't, just because of them, you can't ruin this wonderful country. This wonderful state that they created. And one of the stories that somebody told was they went there on a ski. A lot of people would go to Germany for ski trips. And so they were on a ski trip in the Alps there in the south of Germany, and they were a tree had fallen over across a ski route. And as they were coming down the ski route, they had to stop, and they said it was amazing. Out of nowhere, a line of children perfectly dressed on skis wearing lederhosen came in a perfect line out of nowhere, surrounded the log that was blocking them and moved it, swept the trail clean, and then disappeared into the woods, and everybody just continued down. They said the organization of it was unbelievable. Talk about trains running out of time. It was unbelievable. And the kids were funny because the high school kids would write down letters that said stuff like, well, it's a great country as long as you're not a Jew. The kids would be so open about it. It was, like, interesting. There was a Japanese visitor, and he was there. I don't know if he was there on business or something, and he wrote a series of very detailed letters back to Japan saying that these people are nuts. These Germans are out of their mind. They're on some murderous thing that's going to end in, like, some nightmare Holocaust. You know, he was predicting the Holocaust in his letters that he was sending back to Japan. And he was telling people in Japan, don't make alliance with these people. These people are nuts. They're going to lead you to hell. And nobody listened to him, of course, but he wrote all these really eloquent letters
Also, paradoxically, Japan in the 1930s was a highly regimented, militaristic, and jingoistic society. And that's why
he was committing genocide in China.
Yeah, in China, right. But it was never. I've talked to history professors, various different ones who've investigated it. It was not a it was not a Nazi state. It was different. It was a third world state that had built itself up and was not in their defense, but just to say that they describe it when you talk to people in Japan as we were a small country taking over a lot of big countries around us because we had the power to do it, and we used brutality to force them into.
But interestingly, the base
following us
of their ideology was we're superior. We are the superior race.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I don't know, but that's the point I'm making. Whether it's Germany, whether it's the south of the United States.
Well, nobody is as superior as the people who mounted 30 legions to conquer the known world 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
They take the cake and then ruled for 1,000 years.
Yeah, well,
how did the Italians do that?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Well, you know, my explanation is there were a lot of naive people in the world, and they were organized, you know, which is unlike Italy today, where everybody wants to command. You know, when the Roman legion made the turtle, it was basically the tank.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult to stop them with the technology that was available 2,000 years and more ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the German kids removing the tree. It's horrifying.
People love them. They love them. Even the barbarians, they love them to death. That's what the right-wingers are afraid of here, that all the Mexican people and all these people are going to come into America and take it over because they love it so much.
But, you know, if they could organize like the German kids who removed the tree out of nowhere, they would.
Yes.
You know, that story is horrifying.
It horrified the people. You know what the most horrifying story is? This.
It's also incredible, the cooperation and how you can really do something out of nothing.
Yes, they did, and people caught on. They weren't not stupid people. They loved it, and the cost of it, the murderous treatment of minorities and the other, was a small price to pay for the majority of people in that country. It was a small price to pay. They knew it. They're not stupid people. They're the friggin' Germans.
Yeah.
They're smart. Pardon?
Does it sound familiar?
Yes. Of course it sounds familiar. Okay, we're a pretty Germanic country ourselves.
You had the great Franklin Roosevelt pass all that wonderful legislation in the 30s. Who gets thrown under the bus?
People of color.
There you go. To this day. Right? You got Joe Manchin and Christine Sinema. Oh, did you hear her today?
Yes. I played it on the news. I played a clip for the news.
I know. That's where I heard it. You might as well throw up. I mean,
I try not to.
Because you have morals.
I got a garbage basket next to my chair when I'm doing the news. So in case I have to vomit, it's right there.
You know, I mean, beyond hypocrisy. I mean, it's just. Okay, so not only is she cutting the throat of the whole party, right? Because if they had any hope, see, if they had passed that Build Back Better back when they passed the other bill, okay, the one that has to do with just brick and mortar and a bunch of rich companies going to get richer. Right, the public partner, private partnership. I knew I'd get it eventually. If that had gone into effect back in December, even as late as December, you would see the child tax credit doesn't expire. Right, then all the poor white people would be getting money, and they would say. Well, you know, that Biden guy, he's not Trump, but look, we're getting paid here, and the things look like they're getting better. Mm-hmm. But no, that's not the game. And so how do you get 50 Republicans to stay in line? Right? Remember when the Republican Party...
Because they're a bunch of fascists. If you see Babylon in Berlin, you ever see Babylon Berlin? It's a TV series on one on Netflix or something.
No, I haven't.
Well, that's all right. But there's one scene in it. There's a lot of interesting scenes in it, but one of the interesting scenes in it is about Berlin before the Nazis take over. They're just beginning to take over, and they're starting to win elections. And they have a scene where they're following, I think it's one of the social democratic leaders, and she's talking to a reporter, and she walks into the chamber there of deputies, or whatever they call the chamber there, and you
right.
look up. Yeah, and it's like it looks like our Congress, you know, it's like a big sort of like auditorium.
It's the same thing.
Big auditorium thing. And it's all the parties are different sections, and you have like one third are these guys. All men in Nazi uniforms with the red swastika armbands in perfect unity, silent,
voting as one, doing everything as one. And then the other two-thirds are all the other parties, and it's like a wild madhouse. It's like a WBAI LSB meeting. You know, everybody's screaming at each other. Ah, rah, 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 no, this, no, that. Right? And you know, there you see the problem right there, right? One-third can take over two-thirds when they're that organized.
That's a fact, Jack. And that's why, just as an aside, anybody who's still listening to the station, you need to go to Good Search, do 100 searches about what we talked about just now, because I know that for a fact that you have no clue about all the references that were given in this little talk we've had for the last 40 minutes or so.
Very interesting. I wanted to say, in the postcards from Germany, one of the most interesting stories was in Germany under the Nazis before the war, if you threw a piece of gum wrapper on the sidewalk, you could wind up in a concentration camp, right?
Yep.
That's what fascism, part of fascism. I don't know how they would happen in America, but in Germany, it was absolute hyper insane law abidingness, right? You couldn't even step off the curb. You could literally never be heard from again. You could be beaten to death for the smallest infraction. And so, of course, no foreign person visiting Germany could be expected to follow that. Only the Germans were. So if you were from – that's where they got the idea of people wearing little badges to show that they were not German citizens so that they wouldn't be bothered by the police, right? And so everybody's car had a little, if they were from England, it had a little British flag on it. They wore a little British pin, everything to show that they were not German so that, you know, in case they dropped a cigarette on the floor or something like that, they wouldn't wind up in Dachau or something. And so in one case, just to give you the atmosphere, right? So this couple, the German diplomatic couple, they're pulling up their car and parking, and then they're getting out to go to their office where they were working at the British consulate in Berlin, and they're walking down the street, and a woman runs in a housecoat, runs up dragging a child, and the child has one leg shorter than the other, and she's got one of those shoes, you know, the big thick shoes, you know, right? And she drags the girl over to the English couple, and he says, please, please take this girl with you. And that's the first page of the book. And then they say, what do you think the couple did? And then they don't tell you till the end of the book, the last page, what happened. The guy, of course, was like, huh? And while the guy is like trying to scratch his head, figure out what's going on, his wife immediately grabs the child and goes, yes, and drags her and the husband and the child into the consulate where they make a fake passport for the child and take her with them. And
nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Isn't it interesting?
Because they were euthanizing anyone who wasn't
anybody. Kidding me? That's what. Do you know how when Trump made fun of that reporter? You know, when the disabled, he wasn't even really disabled. He just like cerebral palsy or something. And he was like, I have so many friends with cerebral palsy, different levels of it. And, of course, it does lead to humorous situations at times, but we all laugh together about it. But to laugh at somebody because they have cerebral palsy is really the worst scum of the earth. And, you know, these Christians, I'm no Protestant, right? But I know a little bit about Protestant religion. And the entire edifice of the Protestant religion is based on treating a disabled person kindly.
That's what Jesus did.
Yeah, man, you cannot openly humiliate
Absolutely.
And browbeat a disabled person in front of thousands of people who then cheer it is you might as well take every damn Bible in the country and burn it.
Yeah, well, it's for expediency because if
it's a violation of their own religion.
That's correct, and at least
the central tenet of their religion.
Offer the healing, right? The job as a Christian, my job is to offer you healing.
Of course,
because the healing is already accomplished according to the book. Whether you believe that or not is doesn't matter. But I can show you both scientifically and spiritually. That most of the stuff, as our friend just said, is brought on because we believe things that aren't true. And then we get ourselves sick because our immune systems drop and the body goes. However, let me do the pitch for BAI.
Go ahead. We're running out of time.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said let me do the pitch.
Go for it.
As a 501c3, BAI is eligible for you to gain money by if you have zero capital to share with BAI, go to GoodSearch, GoodSearch.org, and search all the things that you were confused about in our conversation or anything else that you need to find out through the internet. Put in WBAI as your charity of choice and get this station some money, because if we fail to increase the listenership of the membership by approximately 10,000 members, the folks out in the West will take the station away. Period. We need $3 million. We need about $3 million to pull even, and another $4 million in renovation and staffing, and then we can cruise at maybe $3-4 million a year. But currently, we ain't making it, and we'll lose it if we don't increase listenership and get more money. We need minimum of $300,000 this year, as of today. To get the title fund, you can just do that if you want, but we need another $300,000 on top of that. So let's get to it. That's a lot of searching, or you can shop at bookshop.com.
All right. There you go. And there's lots of good books. I should go through my, any of Sharar's books.
I'm trying to get you to do the work on the gifting platforms so we can increase employee matching and figure out how you can shop. If you have to shop with Amazon, shop through their gift portal and put BAI in as your charity of choice so that we can get a cut off the money that Amazon is making off your butt.
All these brilliant ideas. What a brilliant idea. All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Send me the email, Paul.
Yes, go for it.
Paul, I want to put in something because...
Quick, we don't run out of time. Sante, go ahead.
I couldn't hear you anymore.
All right, Sante, go.
I've been listening to you on delay, and I didn't want to speak out of time.
1 minute.
It's ironic, considering our previous interaction. You know, I resented you calling me a technophobe on the air, and I answered you on WhatsApp.
Your phone's working better this time.
But you called me by name, and you called me a technophobe. And now your faulty equipment doesn't make me hear what's going on. I literally had to go back to my...
Well, I'm not the only one who's complaining about your phone.
Because otherwise I didn't know.
I'm not the only one complaining about your past phone.
Conversation tonight. Thank you, Daryl. And I hope we can do more of this and less of the invective-based rants that sometimes happen on this program, too. But it's a mixed bag, and that's the way Bob Fass had it. So kudos to you, Paul, for continuing the tradition and the beautiful work. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And everybody else who was on tonight.
Thank you. I don't want to compare myself to Bob, because Bob was such a unique character, and I make no attempt to even try to be close to him. I'm way too opinionated and to be just like he was, but you guys helped me. You know, you were the guys who called all the time when Bob was there, and you educate me on how to do it. So I appreciate you all. Thanks a lot for joining us. And what am I going to say here? It's been a great time. It's been a really interesting time, and I really appreciate it. And just remember, it's all about nature.